Good afternoon, everyone. We're back in session in docket HP07-001, application of TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LLP. And we had just concluded the cross-examination by the applicant, TransCanada. And at this, pardon me?
This might be as good a time as any to mention, so we don't forget it, Mr. Smith. But I received in the postal mail today, a note from Pam Holfer noted that there was a piece of paper she forgot to introduce during her direct testimony. I don't feel like it's probably appropriate to enter it in at this point, but I wanted to let everybody know that it'll be entered under public comment. I think it's mostly a reiteration of what she presented orally with regard to how close different building sites and homes are to the proposed pipeline route. So this will be entered in under public comment.
Thank you. At this point, I will look to, staff and inquire whether you have any cross-examination, Mr. Hone.
I do, thank you. In your testimony here today, Mr. Hone, you cited some setback information, setbacks as it relates to private dwellings, etc. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Are you familiar with CFR 195-210 that actually contains the requirements for that information?
I'm aware there are requirements in the code.
Did you intend to correctly cite that information here today?
That was the intent, yes. If there's an error or mistake, please reference it.
In the consumer confidence report submitted as TransCanada evidence here today, there's a variety of other types of materials and chemicals that it appears as if your organization has made it a priority to, you know, track and protect against, correct? Materials other than what we spoke of today.
Yeah, actually, we're required to test for these.
Okay. So there's other materials other than what was suggested today. What types of protective measures have you taken to prevent impacts from those materials that could possibly result from a location near an ethanol plant or feedlot if you changed your pipe design in those areas?
Well, most of the elements we're testing for are in raw water. They would be like materials that got into the water and your pesticides, for example. Runoff might reach the creek, run to the Missouri River, and we're testing the raw water and the treated water to make sure we don't have any of those things. So the majority of this is really looking for something in the source, the river, Missouri River. As far as projects that we plants, like an ethanol plant that we're getting near or bringing a line into, we install the master meter for that installation off-site, right on the edge of their site, and then they pipe into their plant. So we really don't get into the plant site. We stay outside the plant site. Primarily, we don't want to get into their plant site because they want to control what happens within it, but we wouldn't be anywhere near their any of their chemicals.
And the same for feedlots?
Yeah, the same thing with feedlots. A large feedlot, we would come to the edge of the property and stop. Our meter pit then would allow them to connect their pipe to our pipe. We have check valves in the meter pit so that no flow can come back into our line from the feedlot. There's a double check valve, in fact, is required. So the chance of contamination from a feedlot is pretty limited, in fact, nearly impossible. The main thing this testing is doing is looking at what's in the raw water. And I might say...
Steph has nothing further.
Do other interveners have cross-examination, Mr. Hone? Not seeing any commissioner questions. Commissioner Johnson.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Holm.
Good afternoon.
Did you review the HCA maps that are on file as part of this application?
I did.
Okay. Did you had noted earlier that you believe the categorization of a rural water system as an HCA or not as an HCA was made by TransCanada's experts. Is that right?
That's my understanding.
Were the pipelines of the rural water, of your rural water system, were they contained on that HCA map? Were they located as an HCA? That's probably a question I can't ask. I don't know. I guess I would look to Mr. Kennecke and his team to see whether or not he thinks that would be in violation of the confidential information.
It seems to me, Commissioner, that you know, asking him what's not there is probably not a violation. If the answer is no, you know, then it isn't. If it's yes, then it might be. I can't guide you much more than that.
Yeah, I think that's true, unless the questions become so specific that you're in effect indirectly disclosing what's on there. But so far, we haven't come anywhere near that with questions here.
Mr. Hone, any response?
The HCA map that I reviewed, I did not see any rural water system pipeline showing on that map.
Okay. I was hoping I should have taken an opportunity over lunch to review the transcript. Didn't have an opportunity to, but did you note that everywhere that your pipeline crosses the Kaneb line, you've installed those casings? I know in at least some instances you have, in all instances has Webb.
I can't testify that we've done it in all instances. To my knowledge, we have done it. The piping has been cased, the ones that I'm aware of. And some of those would have been new lines that might have been put in since I came back. Part of what I'm basing that statement on regarding the original project is there are staff that were inspectors on that project while I was gone, and I'm relying on what they're telling me.
But you just don't know for a fact that there's casings?
I don't know for a fact that in every case there is, no.
Do you know if Webb Water is using rubber gaskets at those crossing locations?
We very likely are using rubber gasketed pipe, but if we cased it, the pipe would be inside a steel casing.
Sure. Mr. Hone, on page 6 of your pre-file direct, you note that the commission hearings, public comment meetings on this topic, left only limited time for question and public input. Did you review the transcripts of those public meetings prior to preparing your testimony?
I did at least two of them. I think Yankton and maybe Alexandra.
Was there something in the transcripts that led you to believe that there was only limited time for questions?
Well, it's the probably the same reaction that was raised by others. It's not critical of the commission, but there was a lot of time spent with TransCanada, and I felt some people were leaving before they were able to comment. And maybe it's just the number of people made it not possible. As you know, that some of those got kind of late, like the one in Alexandra.
Sure. Would it surprise you if I mentioned that 17% of the pages of those four transcripts dealt with TransCanada's presentation, and the other 83% were either citizen or commissioner comments or responses to those questions?
I've never looked at it, but I guess I wouldn't be surprised based on the number of pages.
Okay. Would it surprise you if I mentioned that the last comment made by any of the commissioners at those meetings was asking if there were any additional comments or questions?
No, I wouldn't be surprised. I heard you say that.
Okay.
At midnight once.
Yeah. I believe you mentioned that if it went any later, you were going to turn into a Republican, right?
Yeah. Right. Hearsay.
Were you in the room when various subpoenaed state officials mentioned their involvement in discussions with TransCanada as a part of this their proposed pipeline?
Yes.
Okay. Was there a reason on page 6 of your direct you noted at the end of the first full paragraph that no state agency gets involved?
see, which you're on page 6?
Yeah, page 6. It's the first full paragraph, the last 5 words. You note that no state agency gets involved.
Well, this was written based, you know, prior to this hearing, and I learned more about their involvement at this hearing. Mm-hmm. But what I'm speaking of there is, and maybe it's just this is how it's done, but it seems unusual that the state agencies aren't more involved. In fact, presenting direct testimony instead of being called. Now, maybe that's just not the way it's done. But when my projects go in, Webb's projects go in to be reviewed, you know, we go through a fairly direct state review with written comment, and maybe that's just not how it's done in this proceeding.
I think exhibit Web Exhibit 7D, and we should probably pause to make sure we're looking at the right thing here. And I think that's the PHMSA special permit.
Yes, I have it.
7C, 7D web exhibits.
Yes.
It's your exhibit. Are you aware that PHMSA found on page 2 that the proposed pipeline would have a level of safety equal to or greater than that which would be provided if the pipeline was operated under existing regulations?
I guess, can you refer me to that?
Sure, it's page 2. It's in the, you know, it's the second full paragraph. It's right under findings, and it's the second sentence in that paragraph.
Yes, I see that.
Okay. Given that in Webb's Exhibit 7D, was there a reason that you noted on page 5 of your direct testimony that thinner walled pipe means greater risk for South Dakota?
Yeah, the reason I say that, Commissioner, is what this document is saying and what the conditions they place on it say that it will be safer if TransCanada, in fact, does all the things they promised to do. And, you know, I question whether that always gets done. People commit to things and they're not able to do it. Thicker pipe would be a built-in safeguard. You wouldn't have to worry about whether somebody went out every month and checked this or checked that. And so it's a passive protection. If it's thicker, you don't really have to worry how many times you check it. If they put in a thinner pipe and they say, you know, if you allow me to do that, I'll go out and do more maintenance and checking, we get the protection if they do the extra steps. But even if they go out and check, they may not spot the problem. Example, in Minnesota, where the oil pipeline failed, in 206, the pigs were sent through and they found no pinhole in that area near Clearbrook, Minnesota, and then there was this failure this year. So it's a thicker pipe is a passive protection that you don't have to worry about. You got more steel protecting you. This permit allows them to put a thinner wall in, provided they do certain steps which require them, you know, more staff activity. That's what I was saying.
Okay. On page 11 of your direct, Mr. Hone, I'm looking specifically at the second sentence at the top of the page. And I think you note that there's no way that TransCanada can prove or guarantee South Dakota that a pipeline won't leak as required under South Dakota codified law. Do you know specifically where that requirement is contained in the codified law, that a pipeline not leak?
Well, it's regarding protection of water, and I can't cite the specific, but it's protection of groundwater and protection of the environment. If the burden of proof is on them to prove that they will not violate, then I assume they're held to the same standard as a filling station that puts a tank in and it leaks, or a farmer who spills fuel and affects the environment. I think it's difficult to say they can prove beyond a doubt that they won't have a leak. I guess that's what I was trying to say.
Is there an explicit, to your knowledge, is there an explicit requirement under South Dakota law that a pipeline never leak?
Well, there are laws dealing with spill, and it's a violation of the law if you damage an aquifer, damage a water supply. I didn't cite the specific statute. I could provide that later if you'd like. I guess what I'm saying is it's difficult to prove you will not leak. And at one point, at the public meeting, for example, in Britain, I think and I realized I wasn't under oath and it was an informal meeting, but the representation being made as reported in the news media was it'll never leak, which we've came a long way since then. We now confirm it may leak, it could leak, and hopefully they'll be able to clean it up.
Do you remember who made the public statement that the pipeline would not leak?
Well, I think the story reported by the American News, I think they attributed, the quote I saw was attributed to Ms. Tilquist.
Do you remember, I mean, you were at the Britain meeting, do you remember that being said?
A lot of things said at the meeting, but I do recall I think the reference was the odds are once in 1,000 years or once in 3,000 years, which is, it'll never happen. That's my recollection. And, as I said at that meeting, I'd feel better if they admitted it will leak, and then what are we going to do about it? Because it will probably leak in some lifetime.
Okay. We've talked a little bit about, over the course of this hearing, about a third-party damage. And you're familiar, I presume, with the one-call system?
Yes.
Do you believe that as part of a required permit that TransCanada Keystone Pipeline should be required to participate in that one-call system?
Sure, of course.
Okay. Should any responsible pipeline operator be a part of the one-call system?
Of course.
Okay, great. That's all I have, Mr. Smith. Thanks.
Are there other commissioner questions of Mr. Holland? Commissioner Colbeck.
Kurt. I just have a couple questions that have been dealt with. On the on your direct testimony, it would be page 6. I'm sorry. On your direct testimony, it would be page 6.
Yep.
About halfway to need a national interest, you state that TransCanada provides no direct benefit to South Dakota. Do you feel this to be true?
Yes. When I say direct benefit, I'm talking about, I wouldn't call tax generated off the pipe direct benefit. Direct benefit being, can we ship oil out on this pipe?
Okay. And you're familiar with the Mandan line? Did you have any dealings in the Mandan line?
No, I didn't. I don't believe I was here when that happened.
Okay. The next one would be, let me get to it. I believe, and you please correct me if I'm wrong, the pinhole leaks can't be contributed by the SCADA system, yet you had testified that it was a pinhole leak in Minnesota. Do you know how they found that leak?
Well, this is a reference that was in the Minneapolis newspaper. They were quoting a pipe official who said that in 2006 they had ran a pig device through and no problems had been identified in that area of the pipe. My understanding was the leak was found sometime after Thanksgiving, and it was found by a landowner, I believe.
Okay. Thank you. And then I think you referenced as an exhibit of the resolution?
Yes.
Okay. I know that Commissioner Hansen has some questions here. The biggest thing that I guess I would be concerned is it would be line 105 to 108.
Okay.
Do you know if the South Dakota Rural Water Association required anything of the other pipes that pass underneath the Missouri River?
Only one that I'm aware of that crosses the river is in that stretch of Missouri River between Yankton and Sioux City Yankton and Vermilion is a Kanab, which has been there for some time.
Okay. The Association of Rural Water Systems didn't ask anything of that pipeline? Or were they around, I guess?
I'm not sure they were even in existence. Well, they could have been, but I'm not aware that they took a position on that.
Okay.
I'm not even sure when the pipe's been there quite a while.
And on the thickness in line 120 to 124, do you know if the Rural Water Systems had a structural engineer answer any questions for them?
That reference, 120 to 124, is is asking that the wall thickness be greater than 0.338.
Okay.
And that the protection equal the protection provided for roads crossings, which was 0.551. I don't know. I'm not aware that they had an engineer look at that for them, but one of them could have. I'm not aware.
Okay. The other one is, give me a second here. Sorry, I got mixed up on my lines. It's 110 to 118. I have a little concern with that one. Okay. When you were involved in the discussions, it urges the PUC, the governor, the legislature, the attorney general, the DENR, and South Dakota congressional delegation assure that protection under federal and state laws are. Do you know if that group is concerned that federal and state laws have not been followed as to date?
I think that it's just what it is. It's a broad statement, and they're copying this probably to all of those officials asking for a sort of a broad protection. Okay. I don't think it's saying that they aren't. I think they're saying we'd like you to look to those laws and make sure we are.
Okay. And of the other resolution, 126 to 134, the 15 cent per barrel, assuming that some of the testimony we gave that was given here in the last few days is true. Do you think that they want that applied to the thousands of miles of gas pipelines or just the 200 miles of crude oil pipeline?
Again, I wasn't at that meeting when they finalized it, but just reading it on the face of it, it looks like it's TransCanada specific.
Just the crude oil.
Yeah. And I might, if I could just go back a bit on your question about 10 versus through 18, 110 through 18. I think crude oil is new to South Dakota. It's certainly new to us anyway. And there are some questions about do federal laws protect, what are federal laws, how do they interrelate with an oil spill, a crude oil spill? We've never had that. We've had gas, natural gas go up in the air. It doesn't really hurt our lines. There's been gas spills that have been cleaned up, but we've never had crude oil. And so questions like the HCA question, how do we fit in all of that? And so I think they just did a blanket to all public officials saying it's a new piece of work. It's a new area for all of us, and they want them to look closely to make sure water's protected.
Okay. And I'll ask Mr. Smith to stop me here, but if that 15 cents per barrel, is that something that they're going to take up with the legislature? Something they're
I don't know.
As far as power of the PUC to impose taxes or tariffs is.
I would think they might. If it came up, they certainly would be involved in the discussion, but I'm not aware of anything specific.
That's all for me.
Questions, Commissioner Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Afternoon, Mr. Holland.
Good afternoon.
Piggybacking on Commissioner Kolbeck's last question, perhaps I believe he was asking you if you were aware that there have been a number of times that a 15 cent a tariff or a tax of 15 cents per barrel has been brought up to the PUC, and just your understanding that the PUC does not have the authority to initiate that tax?
Yes, I think we understood the PUC, it's a legislative function or could be a legislative function. I don't know that you have authority to do that.
Okay. On page, I don't know that you have to turn to it, but in your direct testimony on page 9, you explain that the ductile iron pipe has a peak pressure of, operates at a peak pressure of 100 to 209 PSI. I looked through the testimony and suspecting I missed it. What is the peak operating pressure of your ductile, or excuse me, of your PVC?
The PVC pipe, you can get it in a number of sizes. 160 PSI, they normally recommend operate at 120 PSI or less. That's 75%. and 250 or 200 and 250 PSI plastic, same thing, 75% of design. So if we had a 200 PSI or 250 PSI, we wouldn't operate it that high. We'd operate it down at 75%. The ductile iron pipe, a lot of our ductile iron pipe is rated at 350, and the highest we've operated at currently is 209 PSI. So there's a safety factor.
And so the answer is on the PVC, you operate that at what pressure? You say 75%, but
right.
Is it 120, 125, and then the other size you're operating at 150 to 175?
Yeah, each class, there's a class 160, 200, and 250. And the highest we would operate any of those classes would be 75% of that number.
Thank you. What's the standard operating procedure for pressure? I assume you try to keep somewhat in somewhat of a variance for...
Our systems are designed so that there be 50 to 60 pounds minimum at each meter, because the customer is going to want about 50. And then in each meter pit, we have a pressure regulator that if you happen to be in a valley, you're in a low area, and you have 120 pounds outside of your home, you don't want that inside the house.
So understood.
It'd be a good shower, but when you shut it off, you'd have problems. And so the regulator in the meter pit, we adjust the regulator so everybody gets 50 pounds. That's our objective.
Do you ever lose pressure?
Where we lose pressure completely? We have over the years, 20-some years, that might be a pump station shuts off or power goes off or a tank drains down or a leak develops and we would lose water pressure.
But how often does that happen to you?
Not very often, but it happens. I'd say probably... It doesn't happen on the whole system. It happens in places scattered throughout the system. You might see that happen once a month at most, and sometimes it's just on a little branch line. Our system has, and when you say once a month, that sounds like a lot, but we have 6,000 and some miles of pipe, and so really it's pretty low. We're lower, actually, per mile of pipe than many cities.
Do you ever issue boil orders then?
We haven't had to. We've been able to maintain chlorine level, and we've not drawn anything into the line. We might have lost pressure, but we didn't get anything in the line to affect the chlorine.
I believe you stated, but I forgot, where's your purification plant located?
The water treatment plant is about 3 miles east of the Missouri River, at a place called New Everett's, which is 7 miles south of Mobridge on the Missouri River.
South of Mobridge?
Yeah, 7 miles south of Mobridge, and then the treatment plant is about 3 miles east of there. So we have a 3-mile raw water line taking water up to the treatment plant, and then we centrally treat at that one place.
Thank you. And I believe in your pre-file testimony, although I couldn't find it when I was looking for it, you stated how many times, perhaps it's just been in discussion, you stated how many times the Keystone pipeline would cross the Webb pipeline.
Yes, initially, I think the testimony said we assumed it was somewhere between 10 and 12, depending on where the final routing ended up. Based on the routing that I'm aware of today, and that might change because of some easement that moves the pipe, but based on the last routing I saw before this hearing, it's going to be something less than 10, somewhere around 8 to 10. And then the pipe parallels our pipe right at a little, side by side, about 3,000 feet near Amston Lake.
For a duration of 3,000 feet?
Yeah, for a length of 3,000 feet. It's next to us fairly close. I wouldn't say it's 50 feet. But it's on the maps. When you look at, you know, a scale map, it's hard to tell exactly where it is, but it's close to us and parallels us.
And close to is 50 feet.
I'm going to say it's within 200 feet. I don't know that it's 50. I can't tell until they stake it on the ground, I guess is what I would say.
Do you know how many times the proposed pipeline would cross the other, I believe, a total of 8 rural water systems?
When we've gotten together and discussed this, it varied from meeting to meeting. I think as the final routing of this pipe occurred, things were changing with each system. So I don't know today the exact number. It seemed to me that when we first looked at this together as a group, it exceeded 200. But I haven't talked to people lately about that.
Okay, so there's no definitive number on crossings at this juncture?
No, the TransCanada sent us, all of us, a letter with a pipe route. And I believe the pipe route in our area changed a little bit from that letter because of an easement. That Fish and Wildlife, if they're on Fish and Wildlife grasslands, they sometimes make a move to cropland, and so that affects us differently. So the last best information I had was what was posted on your website, which is what we used, and I haven't gotten a recent count, but it was as high as 200 at one time. And when you think about it, there's 220 miles of pipe, and rural water is in most of those areas except for a small distance. So, and we're on every section line, so 200 is not an unlikely number. The two systems, in our system we have a 12-inch. That's the biggest line that's crossed. It serves all of Dade County. For us, that's a real sensitive spot. For the BY water system...
Excuse me, is that a ductile iron, the 12-inch?
No, it's a plastic. BY rural water system, bottom Yankton, has a ductile iron that this pipe comes close to and may cross a few times, and there it's a cathodic protection issue, one pipe versus the other. David Wade has the aquifer, which you've heard about, and then the others have pipes that are crossed of various sizes.
Thank you. The couple questions on, bless you, on the Caneb or whichever pipeline. I'm confused a little bit on the relationship that you have there. I believe you testified that Webb's line is at a depth of 6 feet at the crossings.
6.5 minimum. And it could be deeper than that.
And that the Caneb is at 3 to 4 feet?
I think it varies in our area, and my recollection, and I may be wrong about this, but it seems to me it was in the three to four, somewhere in that range.
Is that to the top of the pipe or the bottom of the pipe?
It would be to the top.
And the thickness of that pipe is?
I don't know the thickness of that pipe.
So would it be safe to say that if that is buried somewhere in the vicinity of 4 feet, taking into consideration the width of the pipe, the diameter rather, that the top of your pipe is approximately 2 feet, 2.5 feet. There's a separation of about 2.5 feet.
Actually, I think the Caneb pipe is quite a bit smaller than this pipe. It's not of the 30-inch size. I should have that with me, but I didn't think to look that up and bring it. But I think if you look at your records, which would have the information on Caneb, I think it's a smaller line in size. And as I said earlier, when our contractors who bid the project approached the gas line, while our plan said a minimum of so many feet, they went deeper. Everyone we've dug up to maintain, they want to stay away from it. So they vary. It's at least 6.5 feet, and the ones we've exposed and worked on are deeper than that. The contractor didn't want to get – he got further away from the pipe than he was allowed to get. He could have been closer if he wanted to be, and he decided not to. So the pipe crossings have – and every one we've exposed to do any work near have been deeper than 6.5 feet, but I can't say they're all deeper. The minimum – the contractor had a blueprint and a set of specifications, and our spec said you have to be a minimum of 6.5 feet deep, and you've got to maintain distance away from the line. When they approached the gas line, they went deeper in the ones that I've seen exposed and examined.
So it was a contractor's decision for greater separation?
Yes.
Your specifications required what sounds like approximately am I correct, 2.5 foot separation?
I think it would be more than 2.5 because a Can-Am pipe isn't as big as this pipe.
But you said it's going to be approximately 4 feet. Yours is somewhere in the 6.5 feet.
3 to 4 feet deep.
Okay.
Can-Am. The ones I've seen vary from 3 to 4 feet. They haven't been that many opened up, but when we do cross now, we try to verify how deep it is.
You understand why I'm asking the question. I'm trying to get somewhat of a comfort zone for your earlier testimony that you want to have a 20-foot separation or 25-foot separation, and yet you've purposely chosen to bury your pipe at crossings when you had that opportunity at just a separation of about 2 or 3 feet. How do you...
Well, the pressure, this is the explanation I would give, and I wouldn't speak for other rural water managers, but from my perspective, the pressure on Can-Am, as my understanding, is less than this line. Pressure is a concern. The other is I've never seen a photograph of a Can-Am explosion. I've never seen the Can-Am fail to the point where it created a crater. Now, I know that's gas and not oil.
That begs me to ask the question, have you ever seen an explosion of the applicant?
Of this applicant?
Yeah.
I've seen the photographs are on the cover of this booklet, testimony. The bottom two pictures belong to TransCanada. Those are TransCanada pipes. They were gas. I've seen several photos of oil pipeline failure, and the recent one in Minnesota at Clearbrook.
All right.
Photographs from a newspaper.
Right. Natural gas. Natural gas on the explosion ones, but we don't...
Well, no, Commissioner, the one in Minnesota, Clearbrook, that is oil. It's this type of an oil line, it's my understanding. The Clearbrook, Minnesota incident from last week.
Correct. Just a little housekeeping for myself. Did your board of directors take an official action at a board of directors meeting to oppose this pipeline?
Every piece of literature we prepared on this issue has been presented to our board in advance of their meeting, and they've approved or signed off on every piece of literature, including this testimony, which was presented to the board about a week or two before they met. And they support my being here today to testify. In fact, my chairman is here with me.
I imagine that answers my question. However, my question is, has the board of directors taken official action to oppose this pipeline?
The board of directors has taken a position, Webb board of directors has taken a position to express concern about this project and to try to seek changes that they think would better serve our area.
Much like the South Dakota Rural Water Association.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other commissioner questions?
I've got one, if you don't mind, Commissioner.
Okay.
And I it's just one question, but it's going to take me a little while to get there, I think, Mr. Holmes, so my apologies for that, because I want to make sure I've got my facts right. Were you around last week when we had an expert testify that the concentration of BTEX in refined petroleum products is higher than the BTEC concentration in a crude oil product?
Can you reference that to a person?
I can't, which is I was hoping you might be able to help me out to verify.
I vaguely remember the discussion. I can't remember who it was, but go on.
Okay. Is it your understanding that leaks are more likely in older pipelines as opposed to in newer pipelines?
Well, based on the statistics that Mr. Miller presented, it showed that the leaks were declining, but they were still quite a number. And maybe we're all just a bit naive in this part of the world because we don't have oil pipelines and we're going to get our first one. But when you look at the statistics, it's declining, but there's still quite a number there from my perspective, my looking at it. And I guess maybe I'm surprised that there are that many.
So if Can-Am is a refined petroleum pipeline, and if you can't say for sure that Webb Water has put casings around its water pipelines that cross the Can-Am, I mean, if you've been the web manager for 15 years, I mean, I guess if you've taken concerns about VTechs and pipelines as seriously as you're asking the commission to take them, why haven't you taken the time to verify that your pipelines are cased?
Well, I believe they are cased, and I'll look to our blueprints and send those to you to respond to that, and they'll speak for themselves. As far as, I think there's a couple of issues. You can't, one pipe is not the same as another pipe. This is just my observation. The KNAB pipe is smaller. A smaller pipe, even the same thickness, has more strength. I'm no engineer, but I work with a lot of them, and I know that that's the case. I'm not aware, and you would know, might know, because you have the records here, whether KNAB has had a spill. That type of pipeline, that size of pipeline. The natural gas pipelines, like Northern Border, it's a large line, and it's, I think it's 42 inch, and it's under pressure. But natural gas goes up, it doesn't spread out. The risk is really fire. If you happen to be there smoking a cigarette, it's not a good thing. In fact, in the training, they say if you're there in your pickup, don't start it up. Don't use your cell phone, walk away if you smell the gas. And we meet with them from time to time on safety training. But this is a bigger line, and the pressure worried me. The first thing that caused me concern on this when I heard about it was the pressure.
So, Mr. Honan, I don't want to put words in your mouth here. I mean, my question was, you know, why haven't you taken the time to verify that those casings are in place at every single crossing? Am I right in summarizing your answer that it's because you view the KNAB pipeline as not as large a threat to leak as the proposed Keystone?
Yes. And,
okay.
And
thank
the other,
you very much.
Well, and the other thing in response to that further is I think maybe we all ought to pay more attention, including water managers. I plan to look closer in the future.
I thought I was done, Mr. Smith. I'm not my pot if I could do one more. So at this point, given that, you know, as manager of the Webb Water System, you've been involved, I think, you know, very actively in this proceeding for more than 6 months, has Webb undertaken any activities to verify that those pipes are cased in the last 6 months?
It's on our list for this, our winter's work.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Commissioner Colbeck.
Yeah, I forgot a couple here, sorry. First of all, before I forget, who paid for those casings of the pipes that are cased underneath the KDEM? Did KDEM pay for them, or did Webb Water?
Webb would have paid for them with the project as part of a project cost, I would assume. I'm quite sure.
Okay. How old is your SCADA system? I forgot to ask you that.
We bought the original system in about 1989, and it's been upgraded about the software, and it's been upgraded about four times.
Okay. So you don't update it monthly or yearly, or we really, or an 18? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we haven't had to. We've taken and purchased every update that the vendor recommended.
Okay. He asked you that. The last sentence in the resolution, I just wanted to ask you, 55 through 58, it says, ensure water resources are protected and that the Department of Environment and Natural Resources be utilized to ensure. Did you by any means take the testimony of the people of the DNR that they were not prepared in cleaning up spills and actually had cleaned up over 800,000 gallon petroleum spills?
You're on page 250.
I'm sorry, page 4.
Page 4.
Line 155 to 158, the last paragraph.
Okay. Let me read that a moment.
Oh, sure.
I wasn't there when that language was added, but frankly, we're not saying that we don't think, I mean, frankly, they're saying use the Department of Natural Resources as a resource. I was frankly quite impressed with Mr. Markley and his team and some of the improvements that have been made over the years. So I think they're saying this is the agency we work with all the time.
Sure.
They regulate us. Sometimes they fine us if we don't do the right thing. Yeah. But we work with them, and we trust that they know what they're doing. And I think part of what was good about them coming in to testify was to sort of bring it all up to speed in terms of what their role has been, and more importantly, if something is built, what will they do? Who do we go to? Okay. I don't deal with Mr. Markley because I don't have groundwater yet. You know, I deal with surface water. But his team, obviously dealing with the Williams pipeline, did a Herculean task there. And there were two things coming out of it. One of them was, apparently at that time, to make that oil company come to the table, took the governor, Mickelson. And it took 10 months. And as a result of that, apparently everybody from the governor on down said, we need to tighten our laws up and get, you may not always have the governor who can go in and make that happen. And so I was I'm glad to hear that, the history on that. I was not around when that happened. But the thing that concerned me, even with all that effort, the full weight of the governor's office, they found it in Memorial Day and got the oil company to agree to it in May, like 10 months. And if you're the family that has a well that's affected by a spill or you can't live in your house because of fumes or something, 10 months would be a big span of time. I'm hoping, I guess, from the testimony, it sounds like things would come to a head quicker than that because of new laws, the current laws, and the enforcement by people like Mr. Markley. So I was reassured by his testimony. I was glad to hear it.
And I think the explanation for the 10 months was there was two gas people right next to each other, and each one denied.
They could argue that it wasn't me, it was the
exactly. But with Crude Oil, it'd be pretty obvious.
Right. Hopefully it was. Some farmers.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Can you please not talk over each other? I'm not getting either one of you. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I just have one last question. Do you know if the South Dakota Association of Rural Water managers were aware that the DNR had been involved in this project for over 3 years?
Well, we were aware that they had had meetings with them to get information and to consult. But you'd mentioned previously, and I guess yesterday, that the meetings had started in 2005. I didn't become aware of this project until 2006. I think the public involvement.
Okay. And me in 2007, so.
Yeah. Okay.
But no, that's all I have for you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hone.
Yep.
Mr. Rasmussen, any redirect?
Just a couple of things. Kurt, there was questions about this fusion bond coating. Are you familiar with that product and how it's supplied?
I've seen it used on projects, and I'm familiar with it.
Do you have some concerns about its application in the field?
I pulled up the website, TransCanada's website, as well as others, and looked at all the data I could find in that fashion, and particularly pipe installation. And the good part of fusion bond is it's done in the factory where you can control the environment. They ship it out on links of whatever length, 40 feet or greater. They weld it in the field, and then they paint that seam, or they coat that seam. Maybe paint isn't the right term. But it's hard to control the environment in the field. If there's humidity in the air or it's raining, it looks like from the pictures they build a shelter around that joint when they weld it and then when they coat it. And that would seem to me, if I were involved in building something and that was required to be done in the field, it's kind of like painting a car outdoors. And so I think that, from an inspection standpoint, would be a tough act to follow or do. You're trying to get a controlled environment out in the open air. So that would be a concern.
You were asked questions about the significant amount of water that Webb has rights to in the Missouri River, and that you're not even using, or you're using just a small fraction of that water at this point in time. That being the case, why would you ever consider tapping into the Middle James Aquifer or any of the other aquifers in the Day County area?
Having the water at the Missouri River and getting it to Mobridge, more than 100 miles away, 120 miles.
You mean Webster?
I'm sorry, Webster. Having the water at the Missouri River near Mobridge and getting the water to Webster, 150 miles roughly to the east, is another matter. Our pipe size, our main, is becoming taxed. There's going to be a point where we just can't get more water through it. And so we have been looking at the cost of developing well fields in the Mansfield area and in the Andover area so that we can put wells down and package treatment plants, small plants, treat water to help meet our peak instead of building all that expensive mainline. And you have to weigh the cost one against the other. we've always known those aquifers were there and had the potential to be developed, and it's a resource we've been counting on. So, you know, having the water at the river, the Missouri River, doesn't mean anything if you don't have a big enough pipe to move it all this way, and we don't.
I think you may have misspoke with regard to one thing you said. You testified that you recollected it was Heidi Tilquist who made a comment at the Britain meeting about the pipe leaking. My understanding of her testimony was that the only place she's been is Yankton.
You're right. It was someone with the firm, and it was it was one of the ladies that were at the hearing in Britain. It was quoted in the American News.
But it wouldn't have been Ms. Tilquist. That's all I have.
Anything following up on the redirect or commissioner questions?
Just a couple, thank you. Mr. Hone, do you have any firsthand knowledge of the incident on the Enbridge pipeline at Clearbrook?
The Clearbrook incident from last week?
Yes.
I was not there. I didn't personally observe.
You just read it all on the Internet or in newspaper accounts?
I read newspaper accounts and spoke to someone who lives in that area.
Who was that?
I'd rather not bring his name up, but he's not. I'm not secondhand information, but he repeated what was in the news.
Did he repeat anything that wasn't in the news?
No, he confirmed what was in the news, I guess.
Do you have any particular expertise with respect to the application of fusion bond epoxy?
I have worked around fusion bond epoxy on projects where it was used. I'm familiar with how it's applied in plant settings, but I'm not an expert on it, no.
So did you take any particular, or do you have a disagreement with what Ms. Kothari testified to regarding the field application of FBE last week?
What I stated is what my position would be. I've been out on a lot of construction jobs, and I've seen products like that applied, and it's the manufacturer's direction and guidance is always it's not as easy as they say to apply something like that in the field. And so I'm saying that trying to paint those seams every 40 feet or whatever the length of the pipe is one weak spot. It's not applied in the factory, it's applied in the field.
Are there any particular aspects of her testimony you'd take issue with regarding the field application of fusion bond epoxy?
Just what I said here, that I think that's going to be a weak spot, and it's not a controlled environment.
Where have you had experience with fusion bond epoxy?
On water treatment plants and power plants.
And how long ago was that?
It's been over the last 20 years at various projects. It's not only used in the oil industry. And not just that coating, but any other coating that you try to field apply.
Have any of those projects been subject to external corrosion in your knowledge?
Well, the projects I saw not only had coating on the outside, quite often they had something coating the steel on the inside when it's related to
water. That wasn't the question. Have they had any external corrosion?
I haven't went back and reviewed.
Very well. I'm interested in your claims to be exploring the use of water around Mansfield and Andover. Have you made any application for a permit to withdraw water from either of those locations?
We haven't yet, but we've met with Derek Isles about a year ago, went down to his office, met in Vermilion with our engineer, DGR engineers, and we've been looking at those fields in terms of well data, the data that's available from water rights as to where sources of water are. In the Mansfield area, it's called the Deep James, and it's a new vein that they've identified.
But you haven't made any application for use of that water?
We're not ready yet. We'll need to do drilling and testing, and then we'll have to identify a site where we want to request a permit. We have to be site-specific.
And it's still your testimony that you're going to begin withdrawing 16 million gallons of water from the Missouri River?
Not 16. The pump station has a capacity of 16. The treatment plant can only treat 12.
So do you have plans to upgrade the treatment plant to match?
We might in the future. At this point, we're expanding it to accommodate three new ethanol plants. that need water.
And where are those located at?
One is located at Redfield, one is located at Mina, and the other is at Aberdeen.
And so it's easier or more cost-effective to withdraw water from the Missouri River for those locations than it would be to take it from a well field at Mansfield?
Not necessarily, but the quality of water they need and want, they prefer the Missouri River water, and they're paying the bill for part of it, so we thought, why not give them what they wanted? The ethanol plants are paying for the expansion of our treatment plant that is needed to meet their needs. They're also paying for that parallel pipe you saw the picture of to get enough Missouri River water to their plants. They did not, because their process is quite sensitive, the ethanol process, they wanted Missouri River water and they paid the cost.
I've got nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any last staff questions?
None, thank you.
Any final commissioner questions? Do you have anything, Mr. Rasmussen, in follow-up to?
No, I don't.
Cross? Your excuse, Mr. Holm. Thank you very much. Does that then conclude your case, Mr. Rasmussen?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And I'm assuming that goes for you, Mr. Hone, too.
Yes.
Okay, at this point, then, we've reached the time for, I guess, staff. Do you want to forge ahead, or do you guys want a few minutes to get, should we take a short break and so you can regroup and get organized here?
I just need to pull my marked exhibits out, and then we're ready to go, so whatever commissioners would prefer.
What do you want to do? Sherry, are you okay now?
I'd be okay for about another half an hour. So if you would prefer to break now so that you're not in the middle of a witness.
Let's break now then so we can handle Mr. Walsh all at one time.
Okay. Do you want to take a 15-minute break? Or we'll break until 3 o'clock. Staff, we're going to reconvene the hearing following a 15-minute break. And please proceed with your next witness.
Staff calls Mr. William Walsh to the stand.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Walsh, please state your name, your employer, and your address for the record.
My name is William Walsh. I'm employed by EN Engineering. My business address is 7135 James Avenue, Woodridge, Illinois.
Please tell us your educational background, Mr. Walsh.
I have a PhD in theoretical and applied mechanics from Northwestern University, an MS in metallurgical engineering from the University of Illinois, and a BS in engineering mechanics also from the University of Illinois.
What is your work experience since college, Mr. Walsh?
I'm a registered professional engineer in the state of Illinois. I'm currently a senior project manager in the metallurgy group at EN Engineering, a pipeline engineering firm. My responsibilities include project management, development of welding procedures for line pipe, developing pipe specifications, conducting failure analyses, and assisting in the development of pipeline integrity management plans. I've also worked as a metallurgist for Natural Gas Pipeline Company of America with similar technical responsibilities. In addition to my applied pipeline experience, I've also performed research on pipeline issues of stress corrosion cracking and strength of corroded pipe while a research scientist at Battelle Columbus Laboratories. I've also worked in the manufacturing field as a project engineer and project manager for Snap-on Tools Corporation and Rexam Beverage Can North Americas.
You were employed by the commission to consult with staff on this case, is that correct?
Yes.
Please tell us in general what you reviewed or analyzed in order to file your pre-filed testimony and to testify here today.
The documents that I reviewed were the application for the permit for the Keystone Energy Pipeline and associated filed exhibits, the petition of TransCanada Keystone for the 80% specified minimum yield strength, or SMYS, special permit, and the grant of special permit by PHMSA.
Did you submit any data requests, any particular party in this case?
Yes, where more information for analysis was required, data requests were made to TransCanada through the Public Utilities Commission staff.
And did TransCanada respond to such requests in a timely fashion?
Yes.
As part of your analysis, did you review the burden of proof present in SDCL 4941B22?
Yes.
You'll find in front of you what's been marked as Staff Exhibit 10. Is this your pre-filed testimony?
Yes, it is.
Do you have any additions, deletions, or edits to make to your pre-filed testimony?
Edits were made and clarified in surrebuttal testimony.
You'll find then in front of you what's been marked as Staff Exhibit 18. Is that your surrebuttal testimony?
Yes, it is.
Can you please summarize your pre-filed direct and your surrebuttal testimony for us, including those corrections that were made in the surrebuttal?
Yes. Ian Engineering was hired to assist PUC staff in the review of the Keystone application for compliance with applicable federal and local laws. Federal statute regulating the transportation of crude oil through the pipelines is the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 49, Transportation, Part 195, Transportation of Hazardous Liquids by Pipeline. Since much of the following testimony concerns Part 195, I'd like to take a few minutes to discuss what is covered in Part 195, how it's organized, and how it continues to evolve to ensure safe transportation of hazardous liquids as new technology and information is implemented. Part 195, which I will refer to as the Code, incorporates the accumulated knowledge of liquid pipeline transport based upon engineering principles, experience, analysis, and testing. It provides protection to inhabitants and the environment in the region of the pipeline. Furthermore, it is the law. Failure to follow the code in transporting hazardous liquids through pipelines results in federal penalties, which can include fines and incarceration. The code is organized by subparts. Subpart A is general requirements, B, annual safety reporting, C, design requirements, D, construction, E, pressure testing, F, operation and maintenance, including high consequence areas and pipeline integrity management, G, qualification of pipeline personnel, and H, corrosion control. My testimony deals with design, construction, testing, and operation and maintenance aspects of the code. My colleagues from EN Engineering will testify to pipeline integrity management and corrosion control subparts. An important aspect of the code is the use of industry codes and specifications by incorporating these documents by reference. Documents are incorporated by reference from industry organizations such as Pipeline Research Council International, the American Petroleum Institute, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, Manufacturing Standardization Society of the Valve and Fitting Industry, the American Society for Testing and Materials, the National Fire Protection Association, and the National Association of Corrosion Engineers. Incorporating these standards, these organizations by reference in Part 195 increases the breadth of the code. Unless stated in Part 195, all parts of the documents incorporated by reference are included as if it were printed in full. This makes the industry documents part of the law. There are 36 documents included by reference, including pipeline design requirements found in ASME B314. And finally, concerning Part 195, I'd like to present an example of how updated technology or procedures become included in the code. There has been some reference in previous testimony to the incident at Cohasset, Minnesota, involving the Enbridge crude oil line. The NTSB report of the incident concluded that the failure resulted from fatigue cracks growing due to vibrations experienced during rail transport. As a result of the report, PHMSA sent a letter to the American Petroleum Institute requesting that the design equations in API Recommended Practice 5L1 transportation of pipes by rail be reviewed to determine if the equations are indeed conservative. API initiated a member-funded research program consisting of an experimental testing phase and an analytical modeling phase with two independent research contractors. If, upon review of the results of the programs, it is found that the equations need modification, the recommended practice 5L1 will be revised. Since API 5L is referenced in Part 195, and API 5L requires all pipe manufactured to its specifications, if transported by rail, to use recommended practice 5L1, any changes to recommended practice 5L1 apply to 5L and therefore become the law. Hopefully, based on this example, it is seen that Part 195 is a dynamic document, changing as needed when new technology becomes available for safe transportation of hazardous liquids through pipelines. The request of the special permit to operate the Keystone line at 80% of SMYS is another example of the evolution of the code. As Ms. Cathari indicated in her testimony, improvements in steelmaking technology have enabled the development of high-strength steels with increased toughness levels. In order to take advantage of this improved technology, PHMSA is granting special permits to pipeline operators who can demonstrate that their pipelines can be operated safely at 80% SMYS by increasing the stringency of other requirements, such as the 4-foot depth of cover and enhanced toughness requirements to protect the pipeline. These conditions demonstrate the federal government's careful approach in implementing the 80% SMYS permit. These conditions for granting of the waiver were submitted into evidence as TC-11 earlier in these hearings.
Are there any issues, Mr. Walsh, that you feel need clarification based on your observations at the hearing thus far?
Yes.
What are those issues?
Part 195.112, dealing with pipe material quality. There are special request conditions pertaining to this section for manufacturing standards and puncture resistance, where I believe further explanation would benefit these proceedings.
What clarifications do you believe are needed regarding the manufacturing standards?
There have been concerns raised about one of the pipe mills contracted for this project being located in India. I've had the opportunity recently to visit the Wellspun pipe mill in Anjar, India. I was contracted to provide consulting assistance to another pipe mill near the Wellspun mill in India during September of 2007. My consultation activities were not related in any way to the Keystone project or the contract between ENE and the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission for review of the Keystone application. While in India, I had made arrangements with the production manager at Wellspun to tour the pipe mill and evaluate the production methods and the quality program. Based upon that visit and evaluation, it is my professional opinion that the Wellspun mill equals or exceeds the manufacturing standards compared to pipe mills in North America.
What clarifications do you believe are needed for puncture resistance?
There appeared to be some misunderstanding between the values of excavator weight that Ms. Cathari was explaining during her testimony and the value for puncture force that I believe the commissioners were asking about. If this is not the case, I apologize for repeating this testimony. The puncture calculation is comprised of two parts. The first, calculation of the puncture force required to actually puncture the pipe, and the second, the calculation of the size of the excavator capable of exerting that force. Keystone's calculations show that the pipe was capable of resisting a force generated by a 51-ton excavator, I believe, and that the largest excavators available in North America were 46 tons. Therefore, the resistance of the pipe to puncture was sufficient. It appeared that the commissioners were interpreting the 46 tons as a puncture force required to penetrate the pipe. Just to be clear, the puncture resistance of the pipe, assuming a bucket tooth of 1.5-inch length and a half-inch width, is approximately 55,000 pounds. The excavator capable of exerting 55,000 pounds would weigh about 51 tons. A second issue with puncture resistance is that the special permit condition number 8 states that the pipe must be puncture resistant to an excavator weighing up to 65 tons, with a general purpose tooth of approximately 3.5 inches by 1/2 inch. This is higher than the 51 tons testified by Keystone at the hearings. but to avoid any confusion that may result from the comparison of the testimony to the requirement of condition number 8, I would like to offer the following. With the tooth size specified by the special permit, the pipe used in this project has a puncture resistance of 99,000 pounds, and the corresponding excavator weight is 102 tons, well in excess of the requirement.
Are there any issues that you requested clarification from Keystone in your direct testimony or sir rebuttal testimony?
Yes.
What are those issues?
The issue of assumptions for calculating drain down volumes for various pipeline segments used for emergency response planning.
And have those issues been resolved to your satisfaction?
Yes. Mr. Thomas from Keystone provided me with details of the procedure in general and for the specific pipeline segment that I referred to in my surrebuttal testimony. The difference in our understanding was due simply to a matter of pipeline terrain resolution. The resolution of the pipeline terrain on the hydraulic profile sheet that I was using was not sufficient to see the product quantities that would be trapped by the elevation profile and not included in the drain down volumes. The procedure used by Keystone in calculating the spill release volumes for the energy planning are conservative, or worst case. All of the liquid in a pipeline segment available to be spilled during release are in fact considered as released. There is no consideration of a lesser amount being spilled because emergency response teams clamping the leak. The calculated spill volume presented in the plot of Exhibit TC20 presents a reasonable representation of the spill volumes to be considered in emergency planning. With this clarification, I reaffirm my statement in the direct testimony that the overall selection of the valve placement locations appears to provide a rational, risk-based approach to protecting HCAs as currently defined.
Do you have a recommendation for the Commission?
Yes.
Based on your education, experience, and review of the documents filed in this matter, please provide a review of your recommendation.
It is my opinion that TransCanada Keystone has satisfactorily complied with the requirements of the subparts C, design requirements, D, construction, E, pressure testing, and F, operations and maintenance of 49 CFR 195, which I have reviewed. I further believe that adherence to the conditions of the special permit will indeed provide a level of safety equal to or greater than that which would be provided if the pipelines were operated under existing regulations.
Mr. Walsh is available for cross-examination and commissioner questions.
Did you wish to offer your exhibits at this point?
I forgot the last time, too. Yes, I would like to offer exhibit 10 and 18.
Mr. White, is there an objection?
No objection. No objection.
Staff exhibits 10 and 18 are admitted. Mr. White, I'm assuming you'd be going first here. That's the order we've been pursuing thus far.
That will be fine, and Keystone would have no questions of Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Rasmussen.
Thank you. Mr. Walsh, the testimony about the puncture rate of the pipe, does that assume the pipe is under pressure or empty, or does it make any difference?
Yes, it assumes the pipe is under pressure.
Your direct testimony isn't, the pages aren't numbered. But at one point you talk about, and it's the sixth page. I numbered it myself, but it would be the sixth page of your testimony, which references the field bending of the pipe.
Yes.
Does field bending of the pipe cause any concerns with regard to pipe strength or have any impact on that?
No, the rate of bending is low enough that it doesn't affect the pipe, the strength of the pipe significantly.
The testimony you gave just a little bit ago, it appeared to me you were reading that. Is that?
Yes.
Okay. Did you prepare the written document that you read from?
Yes, I did.
And the questions that were asked of you then?
Yes.
Mr. looking at it, I think it's the ninth page of your direct testimony. It has a little chart on the bottom of the page. Do you have that?
Yes, I do.
At the very bottom of that page, lines 28 and 29, talks about the response time for high volume area with tier one resources in the new state. It seems unlikely that the calculated spill volume could be contained to just over 25,000 barrels based on this response time. Do you still believe that to be the case?
Well, that was part of the clarification in the SIR rebuttal.
And I'm sorry, what was the clarification then?
That the full volume of liquid that would be available to be spilled from any pipeline segment would in fact be released.
On page, be the 10th page, you talk about auxiliary power will be provided by an uninterruptible power supply system. Will that system be enough to handle the pipeline in the event of a major power failure?
I don't have direct information of the specifications of the amount of power that are available, but it has to be designed to those specifications.
On the second to the last page of your direct, you talk about pressure surges and state that the importance of minimizing pressure surges is increased with the granting of the 80% SMYS special permit. Why is that?
It's because the pipe is thinner in those regions.
And then in the next paragraph, you said we would request that Keystone include the effects of unexpected instantaneous loss of pumping equipment in the surge analysis. That surge analysis hasn't been completed yet, has it?
I don't believe so.
But when it is completed, that's a recommendation that you're making. Is that the way I read that?
That's correct.
There would be less of a concern if the 72% design factor were used with regard to this surge issue?
Well, as stated by the granting of the waiver, that all the pipeline at the waiver condition is as safe or safer than that under existing regulations.
Yeah. But you stand by the statement that the importance of minimizing pressure surges is increased because of the use of the thinner pipe, correct?
Should be looked at closer, yes.
I have nothing further.
Mr. Hone, questions? Mr. Walsh?
Yes, on page 2 of your original direct testimony, between items lines 33 and 47, you state, you make reference to 80% SMYS and came up with a thickness. 0.338, is that correct?
That's what it says in the testimony, but that is also one of the clarifications that was made in the SIR rebuttal testimony.
Yeah, and I want to get to that, I guess. And then on the next page, it's the same question, and you're answering. It's the second part of your answer. At 72% SMYS, you calculate the size, the thickness being 0.375, is that right?
That's correct.
So it would be a 0.10 difference, 10% reduction.
Right.
In your rebuttal, you changed that. You and the representative from TransCanada she questioned it, and you changed yours in your rebuttal. Can you explain why the change?
Yes, I was working with a specified minimum yield strength of 80,000 PSI, and even though that was discussed in some of the application material, the final design was for 70,000 PSI.
And the difference between the 70 and the 80, what's the significance in terms of operation of the pipe and safety? Is it 10,000 less?
There's no difference in significance because any difference in this yield strength of the pipe is made up for an increased thickness.
Based on the way you calculated it in your direct testimony, under that scenario, does the pipe have 10,000 psi per square inch more strength? Is it stronger?
I object. I believe it was just testified to that the strength is made up for in the steel quality. So asked and answered.
Well, I'll overrule it, but
be more specific.
We'll just get to the point.
All right. My question, I'm trying to get to the point, and I guess maybe I need a bit of help in asking the question, but your answer went from 80 to 70. You changed your answer essentially and concurred with their review of your testimony. But what in the process, what happens in the strength of the pipe and the safety of the pipe going from 80 to 70? Is it a lesser pipe?
The pipe becomes thicker, and there is no change in safety.
The pipe becomes thicker going from 80 to 70?
That's correct.
Okay. And on page 3, the top of the page, that calculation, 0.375 thickness, that's the same number that's on the small piece of pipe. We were wondering where I got the number, right? 3.375.
That is the same number, but that's not the number that's used in the design.
I know. That's where we got the number. Okay. On page, I have to go back and see which one I'm on. I guess it's page 9 of your testimony, your direct. Line 20 through 25. You see that there? There was discussion or difference of opinion between you and Mr. Thomas regarding 25,000, and I believe he had a lesser number in this calculation, this scenario with the graph.
Yes.
Can you explain again why the two numbers and why the change?
The hydraulic profile that I had available to me wasn't of sufficient resolution for me to see all of the undulations along the pipeline terrain. So there are regions of that pipeline volume that will not drain down. They'll be trapped in the pipeline. And Mr. Thomas had made available to me the high resolution hydraulic profile, and I'm in agreement with that calculation that all the liquid that is available to be released would be released, and the volumes are, in fact, lower than I had originally thought based on my inaccurate profile.
So when you say profile, you're talking about an elevation map?
An elevation map, that's correct.
And the difference in accuracy between two maps?
Or difference in resolution. They're both accurate.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, resolution. Thank you. Again, I'm going to have to go back and verify the page. It'd be 11, and it's line 34 through 41 regarding firefighting equipment available. Do you see that?
Yes.
Firefighting equipment that would be available at the pumping stations. You're familiar with the type of pumping station they're proposing to construct?
Yes.
What are the practical kinds of fire risk or exposure that might occur at a pump station?
Usually none if it's operated safely.
In the testimony that we submitted regarding the Alyeski pipeline, they showed several pump stations that had failed. Would you have any idea why they might have failed?
I can't conjecture on that.
So, based on that statement, 37 to 41, there will be lower explosion level gas detectors, right? What gas is that detecting? What is that looking for?
That would be any volatile liquid that would be associated with a pumping station.
What kind of gas might come off of a crude oil pipeline? Is there some kind of gas that moves with the oil?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Does the electrical wiring in that building have to meet a certain code to explosion-proof code?
It has to be explosion-proof, yes.
And who would normally, in your opinion, based on other projects, who would normally verify and inspect that?
I'm not sure who would inspect that.
And then there would be fire extinguishers near the door or entrance. When you say fire extinguishers, are you talking about the small red extinguisher, or is it something more elaborate than that?
It would be the small red.
Thank you.
Commissioner, questions? Commissioner Colbeck?
Yes, Mr. Walsh. When you had specified that in Title 49, Part 195, if you don't comply with that, there are fines and jail time. Could you give me an example?
No, I don't have an example, but okay. It is the law, so sure. It has to be obeyed.
Okay. Would it be your understanding, would there be any reason why a licensed electrician in the state of South Dakota could not do the electrical wiring you had specified in the pump stations?
None that I can think of. No.
So they would probably be susceptible to state inspectors just like anything else?
Yes.
Okay. Could you go over that numbers that the 10% again? I did not get that clear in my head.
Are you talking about puncture resistance or the thickness of the pipe?
The thickness.
Thickness of the pipe. I guess I'm unclear which.
The numbers had changed.
From 80 to 70?
Yeah, okay. And you had given an example. I didn't.
In my original testimony, mm-hmm. I was under the impression that some 80% or 80 KSI or yield strength pipe was to be used in the project.
Okay.
And those calculations were based on that. Because it's a stronger strength pipe, a thinner thickness is required.
Okay.
In the rebuttal testimony, Ms. Cathari indicated that there was no X80 pipe being used in the project. It was only X70, so I revised the thickness calculations for the lower strength steel, which results in a thicker pipe.
Okay. So you made calculations maybe like in a Schedule 40 pipe when you found out it was like maybe a Schedule 30 pipe, so you had to adjust.
The Schedule 30 and 40 refer to
size.
Refer to thickness, so
yeah.
It's similar to that, but in that case we'd be adjusting the strength to keep that proportion equal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hansen.
Afternoon, Mr. Walsh.
Good afternoon.
Your testimony presents a lot of interesting information on the quality of the pipe, the strength of the pipe, and I think it addresses a lot of my concerns about the potential for failure and potential for any leakage. I'd like to, however, have you educate me just a little bit. I hope it doesn't take too terrible long to do it. I don't have a page number here. I believe it's page 4. I'll just read the portion that I don't think it's important that you turn to it. On your direct, towards the bottom, on condition 4, you were talking about what provisions for pipe material quality are being used in the Keystone Pipeline. And you talk about Sharpie V-notch and drop weight tear testing. Looking for something in layman's terms here.
Okay.
The question that I have, there's two questions. One is that the stipulation you referred to should ensure that the ductile fracture propagation will not occur in the Keystone. I assume that means what it says, but explain that information a little bit for me, please.
The ductile fracture propagation properties are indicated by these by the shear area of these tests. The tests have notches in them, so they're intended to fail at a certain location, and it requires a certain amount of energy to pull these apart. The more energy required to initiate a crack, the more tough the material is. The 80% is a reference to the amount of shear area that the fracture surface sees. It takes a lot of energy to create shear area, so the higher percentage of shear area on these samples is an indication of the toughness of the pipe. Just, I guess for clarification, what toughness really means is the ability of the material to resist turning a relatively small imperfection under load into a large rupture. So the tougher the pipe, the better resistance to forming a large rupture from a small rupture would be under load. Is that clear?
It's clearer. Well, crystal is perhaps not the right term. On condition 2, you speak of manufacturing standards that the API 5L specification level 2 is the highest specification. And within that, we've been talking about this 80%, 72%, et cetera. Looking at you as a neutral observer to a great extent to give me some calm on my concerns for the strength of the pipe. In their application, in some areas, notwithstanding the testimony that the structure needs to be stronger in order for the boring purposes to be pushed underneath. Looking at the fact, and forgive me for the length of the question, but in other areas, it appears that there's reason for having a 72% as opposed to the, excuse me, I get them confused. I'll just use thinner and thicker. The thinner pipe in areas where it would seem that it's not necessarily for the purpose of boring. What concerns would you have if you were a resident in those areas operating a farm, using large equipment, Would you think that there would be a likelihood over a 200-mile area for failure or puncture as a result of equipment being operated?
No, I wouldn't. And a lot of that relates to that condition, too, that you talked about. The API product specification level 2 requires the higher toughness pipe that we talked about in the last question, where if somehow the excavating equipment did dig down to 4+ feet and contact the pipe and perhaps put a unlikely that it would puncture, but perhaps put a dent or a gouge in the pipe, the extra toughness that's required in the PSL 2 level, these toughness values that we're referring to, give it the extra, the extra protection that it would need not to turn a small flaw into a big ripping flaw.
You were here during the discussion, and you alluded to it during your testimony about the 51 tons and the pressure. And in your testimony, you talked about condition 8, puncture resistance, and you spoke to that a little bit. Focusing on just a roadway and the depth that this pipe is going to be buried beneath the roadway, how close to that level of pressure could a vehicle, 10,000 bushels of corn on a, I recognize that they have more axles, but just trying to get an idea, how close would two of those trucks passing side by side, opposite directions, for whatever reason they'd be going opposite directions, fully loaded, I don't know, but what's the chance of that having any effect on that pipeline?
Very little. In my direct testimony, I believe I talked about some at the road crossings. It's labeled 195.256, where there are engineering calculations that are done based on the depth of the depth of the pipe under the crossing and the wall thickness, the diameter, and it calculates the stresses that the pipe sees in addition to carrying the pressure. I did run those calculations and indicated that the pipe that was being used for this project didn't show stresses in any danger of for those crossings. The loads that are used for those crossings are pretty much default standard loads, which are two, I believe they're semi trucks, double axle semi trucks that go over the road, and it is a certain load that's assumed on the road that's going over the pipe itself, and the stresses are well below any fatigue limit, which would be the concern because it's a somewhat of a cyclical repeating load, unlike a pressure load from.
Well, I really haven't seen much of information on temperature changes. I recognize that the product will be heated to go through the pipe. But what effect would you ascertain, or can you even answer this question? Freezing temperatures 20, 30 below zero, extended period of times, and then thawing, freezing, thawing.
Well, the freeze-thaw doesn't have a very big effect on the integrity of the pipe. The main concern is really the very low temperatures, but that's addressed again by condition two of the higher toughness materials that are used in the pipe. The testing occurs at low temperatures to ensure that the steel remains ductile at those temperatures and still maintain the fracture capability that they're designed for.
Thank you.
Commissioner Johnson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Walsh.
Good afternoon.
On page 5 of your direct testimony, your pre-filed direct, you do note pig launchers and receivers, and you note that their pipeline design with regard to those that equipment is generally adequate to ensure the line has a capability for proper inline inspection. Would additional pigs ever make this pipeline, would it be likely to make this pipeline more safe? Safer, rather?
Well, the application, or not the application, but the granting of the special permit places stipulations on how often the inline inspection is required for, I believe it was the first. Well, I think it requires for the life of the pipeline since it's been granted this waiver, and the intervals, I don't recall exactly what they were, but they are specified up and above what would typically be specified by the regulations because of the granting of the waiver.
Is it too simplistic to think more pigs equals a higher likelihood of identifying structural concerns within a pipe?
Certainly, the more often you do it, the better. But it is determined on the rate of corrosion, you know, that would be measured if you found any in the during the inline inspection. But there is a practical limit on, you know, you wouldn't want to do it every month or you just.
There's a point of diminishing returns at some point. Is that right?
Okay.
I think I heard you say in your oral testimony, your direct in response to Ms. Semler's comments, did you say that upon further evaluation and the filing of your SIR rebuttal and information that you received after that, you do believe that the valve placements is now appropriate?
Yes. Yes.
The proposed valve placements, okay. On page 11 of your pre-filed direct, you do discuss surge, pressure surges. Are there any best practices utilized in the crude oil pipeline industry today to deal with pressure surges that have not been proposed to be utilized by TransCanada for this pipeline?
No, I believe they're using the state-of-the-art analysis methods.
Do you have any concerns about this proposed pipeline that you didn't have an opportunity to address in your direct testimony or SIR rebuttal or under questioning from any of the parties yet?
No, I don't.
That's all I've got at this time, Mr. Smith. Thanks.
Thank you. Redirect.
None, thank you.
Any recross, Mr. Wade?
Just a few. Mr. Walsh, is it your opinion that the frequency of pigging required by the PHMSA special permit is adequate to ensure the safety of the Keystone Pipeline?
Yes, I do.
And Mr. Rasmussen asked you about your recommendation that Keystone commit to include the effects of instantaneous loss of pumping equipment in its surge analysis. Are you familiar with the rebuttal testimony of Mr. Thomas on that issue?
Yes, I am.
Do you recall whether he committed to include your recommendation in his surge analysis?
Yes, he did.
Is that satisfactory to you?
Yes, it is.
Just to follow up on a on a question from Commissioner Hansen. Is it your understanding that the product in the Keystone Pipeline will be heated before it's transported, if you know?
I guess I don't understand the question.
I thought there might have been a suggestion.
The liquid product or the...
The crude oil in the pipeline. Will it be heated before it's transported?
I believe it will just... The heating occurs during the pumping.
Okay. So there'll be no artificial heating that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. And as I understand it, you reviewed the compliance of the Keystone design with respect to certain subparts of 49 CFR Part 195. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So with respect to the portions of 49 CFR that you reviewed, is it your opinion that Keystone would comply with those applicable rules and laws?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Any additional questions by Mr. Rasmussen?
Just one thing. Following up on Commissioner Colbeck's question, I just want to make sure I understand. The X80 pipe is stronger than X70 pipe, and that's why then the X70 has to be a little thicker, too.
That's correct.
How many different X types of pipe are there?
There's many.
Okay, how high does it go?
In current practice, X80 is the limit right now.
Okay.
And there are cases of tests on higher level pipe, but X80 is the highest used in practice that I'm aware of now.
Okay, thank you.
Any last follow-up, Mr. Holm?
Yes. On page 5 of your DRAC, this is there was the difference between your original statement was 25,000 barrels might escape the pipe or not be able to be contained. And I just want to clarify, your statement then would be now is that it's 21,384. Is that correct?
Oh, that's correct.
Okay. And we're talking barrels of oil?
These are barrels.
At 42 gallons a barrel, is that, how many gallons is that?
I'd have to calculate that.
Would it be, would 890,000 sound about right?
I'd have to calculate that. I'm not that quick.
Okay. Well, I'd like to, the people in the industry always talk barrels, and those of us in water talk gallons, but I calculated, and it looked to me like it was in excess of 800,000 gallons.
You don't object to that. I think the witness has answered twice that he's not comfortable calculating that number on the stand.
It's an arithmetic calculation, anyway, that anybody out there can perform.
That's the question, I guess, is that's a sizable amount of oil, isn't it? If that leak were to occur.
It's a relative question, I guess.
Have you ever seen a leak that large? Or inspected a leak that large?
No, I haven't.
Okay. And then with regard to the crossing, road crossings, I think one of the commissioners asked you about road and highway crossings and the strength. Have you seen oil pipelines installed across highways where the pipe was sent through a second casing?
I haven't seen the installation process, but I've seen them excavated.
Would one advantage of having a casing under a highway be that it directs, if there is a leak under the road, it directs it to either end of the casing?
I think that was the original intent of casing pipe.
The applicant testified, or one of their people testified, that the reason they prefer not to put casings in is it conflicts with cathodic protection. Would you agree?
That's correct. That's my understanding.
Okay. And one last question. When valves and check valves are installed on a pipeline of this type, is the valve flanged?
It's typically welded.
Typically welded to the valve?
That's correct.
Okay. In your resume, it looks like it must be the first page of your VITA. Under project experience, it's the 1, 2, 3, 4th item down, microbiological influence of corrosion.
I'm going to object that this is going well beyond the scope of the redirect.
It certainly is.
So that's it.
Is it a question you feel...
it's not been addressed before, and frankly, I hadn't noticed it until now.
Go ahead and ask it overruled.
What is meant? What type of work were you doing when you were doing this work? Microbiological influence.
MIC, microbiological influence corrosion. I was a research scientist at Battelle at the time, and we were looking at modeling pressure cycles on stress corrosion cracking, the rate of stress corrosion cracking. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was for MIC.
MIC, yeah.
Okay, I guess I don't have that in front of me. Let me find that.
Okay.
Oh, this is the project experience. Okay, I understand. And what was the question again?
The question is, part of your project experience was working with MIC leak in pipe. What is it?
It says a pipeline drip, and this is a feature in natural gas pipelines where the drip is connected to the pipeline located beneath it. And any liquids that are entrained in the gas stream go into the drip, and the drip is frequently blown, they call it, where the liquid is removed.
So it's a smaller pipe that comes off the bottom of the pipe?
I believe, I'll object to this irrelevance. We just heard it's natural gas.
Sustained.
I didn't know that when I asked the question. Thank you.
Could I ask you one last question? Again, I'm probably outside of the cross-examination bounds, too, but I can't remember the page. It's, where you got your two bar charts in your direct here. Again, we're back on the road and railway question. It's before the two, the section analysis and the spill outflow. It's the page before that. It's 8 or 9.
I think I found it.
The last sentence, you say, typically the wall thickness is determined by the stresses during installation by boring rather than requirement for withstanding vehicular loads. And it is, I recall reading that somewhere in here. I think it was Ms. Cathari's testimony.
Yes, it was.
And does that generally mean that the bearing strength of the pipeline may significantly exceed what would be necessary to bear actual road loads?
Actual road loads and pressure loads, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Kolbeck?
I'm sorry, I just have one more question. It was my understanding that encasing a pipe inside of another pipe encourages corrosion.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, so that's why it's not a good practice.
It's not practiced anymore.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thank you.
Any redirect?
None. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. I think you're done.
Thank you.
Is staff ready to call its next witness?
Staff will now call Mr. David Schramm.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you.
Please state your name, employer, and business address for the record.
David Schramm, 7135 James Avenue, Woodridge, Illinois. I'm employed as Vice President, Senior Project Manager by EN Engineering. We're an engineering consulting firm specializing in pipeline design services for the oil and gas industry.
And please tell us about your education and work experience.
I have a BS degree in resource management from Iowa State University. I've worked in positions of responsibility, having over 26 years extensive experience in the application of corrosion control, cathodic protection, and pipeline integrity. For the first 10 years, I worked in the corrosion cathodic protection consulting industry. During this 10-year period, I was involved with the monitoring surveys along the Trans-Alaska pipeline system and assumed responsibility for the corrosion control program on the Lakehead pipeline portion of the interprovincial pipeline system, which is now Enbridge. During this period, I also performed work on other metallic structures, including the assessment and protection of lead sheath cable, ductile and cast iron piping systems, water well systems, underground and above grade storage systems, metallic dock structures, and heat exchangers. During the next 10 years, I was employed by Northern Illinois Gas, which is now Nicor Gas, directing the corrosion control and cathodic protection programs to protect 7 underground storage gas systems, approximately 2,500 miles of large diameter gas transmission pipeline, and a large gas distribution system which surrounds the city of Chicago from the Wisconsin border to approximately the middle of the state. During this period, I was also managing the research and development laboratory operated by Nicor Gas. Since 2002, I am employed by EN Engineering with responsibilities that include the technical support of the pipeline and corrosion control service offering, including the development and maintenance of technical specifications and procedures, project oversight, quality assurance for corrosion control, cathodic protection, field failure and integrity management projects and proposals, and the qualification and training of corrosion control, field failure, and system integrity personnel. I am certified by the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, both a cathodic protection specialist and a corrosion technologist.
And you were employed by the commission to consult with staff on this case, is that correct?
That is correct.
Can you tell us, in general, what you reviewed or analyzed to file your pre-filed testimony and to testify here today?
I reviewed the application for the permit for the Keystone Energy Pipeline and associated filed exhibits, the petition of TransCanada Keystone for the 80% specified minimum yield strength special permit, and the grant of the special permit from PHMSA.
Did you request any information from any party to the case?
Yes, to TransCanada through the Public Utilities Commission staff.
And did TransCanada respond in a timely fashion?
Yes.
And as part of your analysis in this case, did you review the burden of proof contained in SDCL 4941B22?
Yes.
You'll see in front of you what's been marked for identification purposes as Staff Exhibit 8. Is this your pre-filed direct testimony?
Yes.
Do you have any additions, deletions, or corrections to make?
No.
If you answered, were asked those questions today, you would answer the same?
Yes.
You'll also see in front of you what's been marked as Staff Exhibit 16. Is that your pre-filed sir rebuttal testimony?
Yes, it is.
Can you please summarize your sir rebuttal, your direct testimony and your sir rebuttal testimony there in front of you?
Yes. My testimony addresses the relevant portions of the federal requirements related to the design, construction, and operation of the facility with regard to 49 CFR Chapter 1, Subpart H only, corrosion control. This represents Sections 195.551 through 195.589 of Code. Section of Code prescribes the minimum requirements for the cathodic protection of steel pipes against corrosion. In general, this section of Code relates to the protection of facilities from external, underground, or submerged, internal, and atmospheric corrosion. It also prescribes to issues related to supervisor qualification, monitoring and document retention, electrical isolation, stray current interference, and assessment and repair methods if corrosion is discovered. Applicable testimony, the PHMSA grant of waiver and the TransCanada petition were all reviewed in contents to the regulatory sections of this code section. In my initial testimony and documented review, the information received was found to meet or exceed the intent of the code sections under subpart H, with the exception of 7 sections where additional documentation was necessary in order to determine intent. In my SIR rebuttal, additional information was provided by Mira Kothari on these 7 sections. Based on this additional submittal of information, the provided information was found to meet or exceed the intent of all the code sections under subpart H.
You've heard some testimony today regarding field application of fusion bond epoxy. Can you tell us a bit about your experience regarding that procedure?
Yeah, the application of fusion bonded epoxy in the field is done through 2 methods. One is either induction fusion or liquid epoxies is the other kind of form, which is really not a fusion bonded epoxy. Both of those involve inspection work, surface preparation, and confirmation using for holiday detection, looking for defects in the coating prior to burial using what's called a holiday detector or more traditionally called a Jeep. Okay? The coating as far as surface preparation is done to standards. There is a defined set of standards either through SSPC, which is the Steel Structures Painting Council, if I remember the SSPC acronym correctly, or through NACE documents as well, National Association of Corrosion Engineers. They prescribe the type of coating that, or the surface profile that needs to be done, to what level does that profile need to be done, how solvents are removed in that pipe. Typically on induction fusion bonded epoxy, the pipe is then heated by an induction clamp to drive off both moisture, as well as to heat the pipe up to bring it to a temperature where the epoxy pellets are then applied and melted, very similar to what the mill application is doing as well. So the same surface standards, the same quality standards are all done at the field location. Materials allowed to cool or come back to a normal temperature basis for that application, and then it's electrically inspected for holidays, exactly the same methods that are done within the mill applications.
Do you have any recommendations for the commission today?
Yes.
Based on your education, experience, and review of those documents, could you please provide a summary of the recommendations?
As documented in my testimony, Keystone has the intent to meet the code requirements contained in U.S. Department CFR Part 195, Subpart H, and provides applicable and appropriate industry reference documents and standards that Keystone will use. For some sections of code, Keystone is taking a more proactive approach to exceed the code requirements, whether done voluntarily or directed under the grant of waiver.
And with that, I will offer Staff Exhibit 8 and 16, and the witness will then be available for cross-examination.
No objection.
No objection.
Staffs 8 and 16 are admitted, and Mr. White, is it you again?
It is, and Keystone would have no questions of Mr. Schramm at this time.
Mr. Rasmussen?
Mr. Schramm, you mentioned in your direct testimony a breakout tank. What is that?
A breakout tank is part of the process facility. It's sometimes used to temporarily handle material before it's re-injected or reused. So it's basically a process tank used in the process.
What advantage are there to breakout tanks? Why are they used?
They're used as part of the process of moving oil. I believe in the testimony I presented, there are none in the state of South Dakota.
Are they a safety factor at all?
No, the only requirement on which I had to look for from code under subpart H is whether or not they are cathodically protected or not cathodically protected. Since there are none, I have no.
You didn't have to look at that then.
That's correct.
Okay. With regard to the special permit, there's these 51 conditions attached to it. Who monitors TransCanada's compliance with conditions like that?
The way I understand the document is that TransCanada must supply information back to PHMSA as to their accountability in those questions, especially with regard to close interval survey and those actions along the pipeline with regard to that grant of waiver.
In paragraph 19 of your direct testimony, you mentioned that TransCanada has chosen to not electrically isolate the pipeline from pumping stations. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, under the section of code that relates to electrical isolation, the code section prescribes that if you choose to protect your facilities as an integral unit, all of it together, you do not need to use electrical isolation. If you are going to apply cathodic protection and basically break it up or not choose to protect it all, then you can use electrical isolation and would put that in place. So since they chose to electrically continuously protect everything and not install electrical insulators, they are meeting that code element because they've chosen not to do that.
By not electrically isolating the pipeline, does that make it more susceptible to lightning in any way?
No.
You talked about the field application of fusion bond epoxy and the various requirements. Despite the existence of such requirements, I mean, there are times when people in the field don't always follow all the requirements. Would you agree with that?
That's true.
And if that happens, then you have a potential problem.
That could lead to a problem, yes.
And your testimony certainly isn't that a pipeline with fusion bond epoxy can't leak. You're not saying that, are you?
No.
Are you familiar with any leaks in fusion bond or pipes with fusion bond epoxy in your personal experience?
No.
You talked about a holiday. Maybe just sort of explain, what is a holiday?
All pipe coatings are designed to be as effective as actually possible. Some coatings are better at doing that than others. Fusion bond epoxy is very good at covering so that there's very no spaces left in the coating. A holiday is basically a break in the coating, and that's what the cathodic protection is designed to protect. They're very small. They can't be seen in the eye. And, of course, the inspection is done through the use of a Jeep or a holiday detector to detect those, and then they are repaired as part of the inspection process.
Why are they called a holiday?
It's just a trade name for it's just a holiday. I can't explain why it's just a trade name.
All right. Thank you. That's all I have.
Mr. Hone.
Is it fair to say that a holiday is a small hole or dimple or thinness of paint in the wall, in the paint covering or the fusion bond?
It could be just a less than desired thickness of the pipeline coating, yes.
And so when you run the tester over that spot where that thinness exists, there's an electric current that then comes through the paint and gets to the testing device. Is that what it does?
Yes, the device is calibrated based on the thickness of the coating, based on that calibration. And as you pass that, it's basically a spring that runs down the side of the pipeline. When it passes that point, it arcs. You mark that location, and that coating is then repaired to an acceptable repair, typically more thicker than what was originally designed.
And is the same test done on tanks, coated and painted tanks, to your knowledge?
There is a holiday detection for paint systems as well.
You referred to a Jeep or a Jeep. Would you like to explain what that is?
That's just the trade name in the industry for what a holiday detection equipment is. It's basically, it makes kind of a jeeping sound when it goes off.
Like a chirp?
It's kind of a chirp, yes.
I don't know what P page this is, but it's in reference to Exhibit D of your direct testimony, 195.559.
Okay.
Do you have that there?
Yes.
It starts out that this section describes the properties that a coating material must possess. Is that, do you have that there in front?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So mitigate corrosion, adhesion to the metal, sufficient ductile. What's meant by sufficient ductile to resist cracking?
Basically is that any flexing in that coating, either doing handling or burial, has to be sufficient enough that it doesn't crack when that's being handled, so it's ductile.
When pipe of this type that's being proposed for this project is bent in the field, does the FBE crack or can it crack?
It can, but it would still go through the same inspection process and repair as it through G before it was directly buried. That's a requirement under code.
So it would be tested with the testing device, and if you found a holiday or a crack, it would be coated?
Yes.
I had a question on Exhibit J195.571. Where, do you have it there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And where it starts out, about the third paragraph down, April 30, 2007.
Mm-hmm.
In the center of that paragraph, it's at least one CP. I assume that's cathodic protection station?
That's correct.
Must be located within each HCA with a maximum spacing between test stations of 1/2 mile within the HCA?
That's correct.
What's the purpose of that test station in the HCA, in your opinion?
All test stations are used to measure the application of cathodic protection and take annual readings to determine the performance of the cathodic protection system. So regardless of whether it's in an HCA or outside of the HCA, that purpose is basically to allow connection to the pipeline and to take annual readings through that device.
And if the annual readings were taken, how does that help protect the pipe? Does the reading change and then someone acts on that change?
The readings are used to look against the criteria for cathodic protection, so they're measured and looked against that, and that would be the case. If there are less than deficiencies in cathodic protection, then it would be looked at, and that deficiency would be resolved.
So if you got the wrong reading or a low reading or something that concerned the person taking the test, what would happen? What do you think might happen after that was found?
Typically, if there's a low reading, that reading's confirmed, and then additional investigation is determined as to whether what's causing that low reading to occur, and the mitigation system designed to cathodically protect the pipe would either be adjusted in the case of compressed current systems, or additional cathodic protection would be placed at that location.
And by impressed current, what do you mean by impressed current?
There's two types of cathodic protection systems. One's galvanic, the other's impressed current. TransCanada is proposing to use a impressed current system. It's just a form of cathodic protection.
Is impressed current where electrical current is added or a voltage?
Both systems make use of voltage.
With that kind of testing on an annual basis, right?
It is required under code on an annual basis.
So if you're getting a reading that the test technician didn't like or didn't think was appropriate, they'd do some additional testing to verify what the problem is? How does it help you protect the pipe, I guess?
It's used in determination of the criteria. Again, the sections that I am designed to look at really was the intent of whether or not they are taking annual readings and they have compliance. This section says that must comply with one of the criteria. Those measurements are used to comply with the criteria, and so under code, under subpart H, by taking these measurements and using the criteria, they have established a criteria they meet under section H, the right requirements, so they are complying with that code element.
And the reason for the code is to protect the pipe from corrosion?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Commissioner, questions?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to South Dakota.
Thank you.
Just a couple of questions, I believe. On question 9, 15, 16, 22, 23, 24, and 26, you make the statement that Keystone's plan, in each case you, I believe you refer to a different exhibit, needs additional documentation, and providing the additional documentation is recommended as a condition of issuing the construction permit. Will there be oversight other than the PUC as to the issuance of that construction permit? Will you or your, are you aware of any federal or state regulation that would prohibit the issuing of the construction permit unless these are met?
No. In fact, in my SIR rebuttal, I removed that because I eventually received the information I needed to determine intent against the code items.
Thank you. A question, in a number of the questions as well, you refer to best practices. Are there any areas that you're aware that Keystone has not adopted best practices?
Within subpart H, no.
On question 19, being a novice on this, I was trying to figure out exactly why TransCanada is taking a good proactive approach. You stated that they are taking a good proactive approach and have selected best practices. However, as I read the question was, must Keystone provide electrical isolation? And the answer is they have chosen not to electrically isolate the pipeline. Why is not electrically isolating the pipeline a good idea? I thought that was not a good idea.
In the terms of their protection of their facilities under the code, they have a choice to do whether they can electrically isolate. Some companies electrically isolate at pump stations, or in the case of dissimilar metals or different piping systems based on age, such as distribution pipeline companies. So the use of those insulators are to help them to understand and control the pipeline system. For a new pipeline system like TransCanada is proposing, they have chosen to not put the electrical insulators in, which is their real choice on how to do that under code. It allows them to install more concise cathodic protection systems primarily within the pump stations, which they're proposing, that will also protect the pipeline facilities. It removes the electrical isolation devices, which would then need to be monitored on an annual basis and also protected against lightning strikes, because that lightning strike would come up to that insulator and could jump across there. So by removing that, they've also reduced that risk from those capabilities, that issue as well. So in the terms of when I reviewed the document and how they were proposing to design the pipeline system electrically by not putting electrical insulators in and to protect the system by the methods they're choosing, traditionally that method on what they're choosing is I would call a best practice on how they were doing it. So that's why I noted it as being best practice.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fram.
Other commissioner questions?
Hi, thank you for being here. I just have a few. Are the corrosion factors for gas or refined crude and crude oil different?
I'm sure I understand the question.
We've had a lot of examples of gas pipelines and crude oil pipelines and trying to get a good comparison. Does the inside of a gas or petroleum pipeline corrode faster or not as fast as a crude oil pipeline?
I'm not sure there's a real good way to answer that. Each of the products has their own sort of unique characteristics that you need to address through design characteristics. In a wet gas situation, obviously, you have wet gas. The wet gas is the water within the gas that's causing the issue.
Yeah.
Here in the crude oil, the same issues there, and TransCanada has reduced the sediment as well as the water intake, and they're showing a turbulent flow through their modeling, and so that basically would take any water and sweep it through the pipeline system. So they're all unique to the type of product and the type of system, depending on what you have.
Okay. So there's really not a good apples-to-apples comparison?
Not really.
Okay. Does the outside temperature matter in the application of the FBE?
Outside temperature, fusion bonded epoxy is usually applied at over 400 degrees, depending on what the temperature is. I believe the pipeline, from an operating standpoint, is around 100 degrees, so there's a great difference between when it's going to operate versus when that would, you know, need to be applied. So, yes, there is a temperature criteria recommended by the manufacturer that would have to be met as part of the inspection requirements for TransCanada during the application.
Okay. If it's raining that day or 110 that day or 40 that day, does that matter?
It shouldn't. That kind of material is applied from the Arctic Circle down to the equator. So, there's different formulations. Again, they're using induction heating equipment.
Would you ever suggest a case-in-case method to be used for safety, a pipe inside a pipe?
I would not recommend the use of a casing on a pipeline.
Why would that be?
They were traditionally used in the pipeline industry for a very long time. There are two, and I believe Meredith Gathari covered this in her testimony as well. But there are two cases. One is called a metallic short, where the casing actually becomes in contact with the carrier pipe. So they basically touch each other. When that happens, the cathodic protection system is no longer protecting within the casing. There's also what's called an electrolytic short, where you have fluids that fill up inside the casing, and that produces what appears to be an electrolytic short. And so corrosion could occur under those aspects as well. And so traditionally, those aspects would tell you not to do those anymore, and most pipeline companies today no longer install casings.
Okay, thank you.
Any last commissioner questions? Seeing none, redirect.
I have one. You were asked a question by Mr. Rasmussen about the field work and that epoxy bond process and whether or not there could be an inconsistency or a mistake potentially in the application of that in the field. Do you know if there would be an inspection process after that application in place to find that sort of inconsistency or mistake?
There's an ongoing inspection as the whole entire coating is done. There's measurements to look at surface profile and other things that could be taken. But yes, to answer your question, that the electrical inspection of that pipeline at the end would be the final inspection, typically done before the pipeline is installed down into the ditch.
Thank you. Nothing else.
Mr. White, additional questions?
Just a couple. The inspection process that you just described with regard to field application of FBE, In your opinion, does that provide an adequate level of assurance that the FBE coating, by the time the pipe is lowered in the ground, will have been appropriately applied?
Yes.
Okay. And I believe you indicated that you reviewed 49 CFR 195 subpart H, and as a result of that review, did you reach a conclusion as to whether the Keystone Pipeline would require, with all applicable laws and rules as they relate to that section of the code?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Rasmussen?
Your testimony about the casing, that wouldn't apply to putting a plastic pipe inside a metal pipe, would it?
That would be correct.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Trying to find where in your testimony. Is your direct testimony Exhibit D, 195.559? It's the second page of that. It looks like it's Q7-1 and then R7-1. Do you see that?
Yes.
The question you asked there related to how many failures or incidents related to external corrosion have occurred, and the answer responded to external corrosion. Did you ask the question about internal corrosion, a similar question?
I think we're beyond the scope of redirect here. I object.
Oh, do you even remember?
I'd have to dig through here. There is a requirement under code for internal corrosion, and mm-hmm. TransCanada is meeting the requirements for internal corrosion protection of the pipeline as they presented it.
This question and answer related to external. Did they know of any externals? And they answered, but did your testimony or did your statement and your questions ever ask about internal? That I guess, is the question.
I couldn't answer without digging through.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up question?
I do not.
With respect to these data requests that were made, is that what you're referring to, the data requests? Did you make data requests only in areas where you deemed the documentation that you had already received to be in need of additional explanation?
That is correct.
Thank you. Any last questions? You're excused. Do you want to plow ahead, or you want to take a short break before our next witness? Good to go.
Short Larry? Break and try to get one more done before end of day?
That's what I'm kind of thinking. 10 minutes? We're going to come back to order. It's just slightly after our time that we had set, but we were having a discussion here among council about an issue. So it's... now back, it's a little after 22, and we're back in session in docket HP07-001, application of TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP. We have a little bit of a housekeeping matter before we proceed with staff's next witness. Earlier we had a discussion about, the responses to staff's first data request. And there was a reference in one of the testimonies submitted, I believe, by the applicant to a particular set of things in staff's data request set 2. And that led to a discussion about whether or not the data request 1 and 2 ought to be admitted into evidence. And it's my understanding that this has been discussed by the parties, and that the parties have agreed to stipulate to the admission of staff's and the responses, the staff's data requests 1 and 2 and the responses to those. Is that correct?
I believe so. You'll have to hear from the other parties, mm-hmm. but we'd been waiting to circle the wagons around, and then it came to our attention that Mr. Rasmussen won't be here tomorrow, and his replacement counsel wouldn't have the benefit of having looked at that, so I thought we'd better bring it up before we close business up today.
Is that?
Yeah, and that's fine for the admission of those.
Mr. Hone, any?
1 and 2, yes.
The data resets. Number 1, of course, has been on the website all along, since almost the beginning. I haven't seen the entirety of 2, but if council has no side has an objection, we'll just admit those. Do we need to give them an exhibit number? Should we?
You're looking at me. Are these going to be staff's exhibits?
Well, you can call them whatever you want to. They're stipulated, but they could be. I mean, they were responses to your data requests if you wanted to. What's your last exhibit number?
20.
20? So why don't we just call them staff 21 and 22, just so we know what to call them. I don't know if you have copies there handy for the reporter. Otherwise, we'll have to get copies for the reporter at the conclusion today.
I don't have copies available.
Okay, we can get those, so
we'll bring copies.
Okay, sounds good. Well, staff, should we, I don't know, did I formally admit those? I think I did.
I think you did.
Okay, and staffs 21 and 22 are admitted, and those are the data requests, the first two sets, and the responses.
Mr. Smith, do you show the draft environmental impact statement as admitted yet?
You know, maybe we should let her get started, and I'll
Very
dig
well.
Around here and look. I can't remember. If so, it would have been your exhibit.
That's correct, and we did replace it and put it in those two black binders on the desk, and they've sat there for a couple days now, but it's something I thought we need to get around to. So,
I will look and see if I find that in my list of exhibits.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
The draft environmental impact statement. We
it was admitted.
That's one of my recollections.
With the understanding you guys were going to put in the full thing.
And we did that, and it's on the table there. Very well.
Okay. Yeah, I show that as TC-15, and we did admit it subject to it being confirmed as being complete.
And we've done that to our satisfaction, and any other party can review it. It's in the two black binders on the right-hand side of the witness table.
I'll have Mr. Tobin review that tonight.
With that, Ms. Semler, please proceed.
Staff now calls Jenny Hudson. Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you, God? Ms. Hudson, please state your name, business address, and employer for the record.
My name is Jenny Hudson. I am currently employed by EN Engineering. My business address is 7135 James Avenue, Woodridge, Illinois.
Please state your educational background, Ms. Hudson.
I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Geological Engineering from the University of Missouri, Rolla. Also, I am a registered professional engineer in the state of Illinois.
Please state your work experience since college.
Currently, I am employed as a senior project manager at EN Engineering. My current job function includes oversight of pipeline integrity projects. I have written integrity management programs for both liquid and natural gas pipeline companies. I have assisted both liquid and natural gas companies during jurisdictional integrity management audits. I have reviewed integrity management programs and helped operators prepare for their jurisdictional audits. Also, I have done work related to corrosion control and cathodic protection.
And you were employed by the commission to consult with staff on this case, is that correct?
Yes.
Please tell us in general what you analyzed or reviewed in order to file your pre-filed testimony and to testify here today.
The objective of my review was to ensure the TransCanada Keystone Pipeline has met the requirements of the Federal Pipeline Safety Regulations 49 CFR 195. Specifically, my task was to review aspects pertaining to 195.452, what is commonly referred to as the Liquid Integrity Management Rule. I reviewed various filing documents from TransCanada, including but not limited to Appendix B, Preliminary Evaluation of High Consequence Areas, Petition of TransCanada Keystone Pipeline for a special permit to design, construct, and operate a new crude oil pipeline at design pressures up to 80% SMICE, and data responses from TransCanada. I also reviewed various documents from the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, including CFR 195.450 and 195.452, PHMSA protocol documents, and PHMSA frequently asked questions.
Did you submit any data requests to a party when you needed additional information to do your review?
Yes, I did, to TransCanada through the PUC staff.
And did TransCanada respond in a timely fashion?
Yes, they did.
You'll see in front of you what's been marked for identification purposes as Staff Exhibit 9. Is that your pre-filed direct testimony?
Yes, it is.
Do you have any additions, deletions, or edits to make?
Yes, I would like to make one addition to line 4 of page 5 of my written testimony. It should state yes, as they have been identified by TransCanada.
You'll also see in front of you what's been marked for identification purposes as Staff Exhibit 17. Is that your pre-filed surrebuttal testimony?
Yes, it is.
Do you have any additions, deletions, or edits to make to your surrebuttal?
No, I do not.
I've asked the same questions today. You would answer the same?
Yes.
With that, I will offer Staff Exhibit 9 and 17.
No objection.
No objection.
No objection.
Staffs 9 and 17 are admitted.
Ms. Hudson, could you please summarize your pre-filed direct and surrebuttal testimony for us?
Yes. In an effort to increase the integrity of hazardous liquid pipelines, the United States federal government instated specific regulations for hazardous liquid pipeline operators to assess, evaluate, repair, and validate pipeline segments that, in the event of a leak, could affect populated areas, areas unusually sensitive to environmental damage, and commercially navigable waterways. As I stated in my written testimony, I was not able to review the TransCanada Keystone Pipeline Written Integrity Management Program. However, from a code standpoint, this is acceptable since, per code, the Integrity Management Program does not have to be completed until 1 year after the pipeline commences operations. High consequence areas, as defined by 49 CFR 195.450, must be identified by the date the pipeline begins operation. Speaking from a regulatory standpoint, at this stage in the process, TransCanada Keystone Pipeline is meeting the requirements of 49 CFR 195.452. To summarize my surrebuttal testimony, the process TransCanada has used for identifying high consequence areas to date is in compliance with 49 CFR 195.452. Per code, HCAs do not need to be identified until the pipeline commences operation. Additionally, in both my written testimony and surrebuttal, I discuss preventive and mitigative measures. A preventive and mitigative measure is a measure to prevent and mitigate the consequences of a pipeline failure. Per 49 CFR 195.452, it is not required for TransCanada to have all preventive and mitigative measures identified at this time.
Are there any areas that you feel deserve some clarification
Yes.
for your observations at this time?
Yes, I do.
What are those issues?
During hearings and in written and surrebuttal testimony, I have heard various terms used, such as geologically sensitive high consequence areas and hydrogeologic sensitive area. 49 CFR 195.452 addresses high consequence areas and unusually sensitive areas. Both of these have specific definitions which are given in 195.450 and 195.6, respectively. An unusually sensitive area is a type of HCA. High consequence areas are specifically addressed in 195.452, and a pipeline operator must assess, evaluate, and repair pipeline segments which they have determined have the ability to affect an HCA in the event of a pipeline release. Geologically sensitive high consequence areas and hydrogeologic sensitive areas are not defined or addressed in 49 CFR Part 195.
Do you have a recommendation for the Commission?
Yes.
Based on your education, experience, and review of these documents, please state in summary your recommendation.
I recommend that TransCanada review the proposed pipeline route and unusually sensitive areas as defined by 49 CFR 195.6 to ensure all unusually sensitive areas having the ability to be affected in the event of a pipeline release have been identified. This should be done prior to the pipeline commencing operation. As appropriate, TransCanada should incorporate any additional USAs into their integrity management program.
with that, Ms. Hudson is available for cross-examination.
Is it Mr. White again?
Yes, it is.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'd like to look at page 3 of your direct testimony. And specifically lines 20 through 31.
Okay.
Apologies, your sore rebuttal testimony.
Oh. It was page 3?
Page 3, line 20 through 31.
Yes.
Where you indicate, I believe, that you're referring back to testimony of Mrs. Anderson, and you indicate that you cannot comment if these water systems that she has identified should be considered HCAs, and then suggest that part of the pipeline going into operation, TransCanada should incorporate local knowledge into the HCA identification process. Is that right?
Correct.
Is that the normal process that's followed in the development of an integrity management plan?
Code and guidance documents by PHMSA suggest the pipeline operators should incorporate local knowledge into their into the development of their integrity management program.
Okay. And who is it that initially identifies high consequence areas? Is it the operator or is it the PHMSA, DOT PHMSA?
The federal government, through use of the National Pipeline Mapping System, has identified high-consequence areas, and in order to develop those maps, PHMSA worked with various agencies.
And then does PHMSA incorporate feedback from operators as they further define, as the operator helps to further define HCAs in their operating area?
PHMSA has stated that they will periodically update the National Pipeline Mapping System.
So looking at the correction that you made to your direct testimony, where you indicate that you review the hazardous liquid consequence areas identified in the state of South Dakota as they have been identified by TransCanada, does that answer then suggest that it would be the high consequence areas as identified by PHMSA?
That would be my assumption, yes, that TransCanada has used the National Pipeline Mapping System to identify their HCAs.
Okay. And then in your surrebuttal testimony, on page 3, lines 43, carrying over to the top of page 4, I think you indicate that the final Keystone Integrity Management Plan, in the final Keystone Integrity Management Plan, TransCanada will need to demonstrate they made a good faith effort to identify all HCAs. Is the Integrity Management Plan submitted to the PHMSA by the operator?
The integrity management plan is subject to review during a jurisdictional audit.
And are there sanctions if the audit determines that the integrity management plan has not been appropriately prepared?
During an audit, yes.
And in your surrebuttal testimony at page 4, you indicate that in your opinion, at this time, based on the information you've received, the HCA analysis performed by TransCanada meets the intent of code for this stage of pipeline design and construction process. Has anything in your review to date caused you to have any concern that TransCanada will not adequately perform the remaining HCA identification process and incorporation into its IMP?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Rasmussen.
how has the national pipeline mapping system been prepared? I mean, how does that come about?
My understanding is that the United States government collaborated with various agencies, such as state agencies, the EPA, in order to develop the information that's included.
And it covers the entire country then?
Yes.
And you said it's periodically updated, is that right?
Correct.
Have you seen the maps that are on file, the HCA maps that are on file for this proceeding?
Yes, I have.
When were those prepared, do you know?
I do not know.
How often are they updated?
PHMSA has stated that they will try to update the national pipeline mapping system every 5 years, pending resources.
Which could mean it could be more than 5 years, depending on, as you say, on resources. Is that right?
I suppose it could, yes.
What you state in your surrebuttal testimony that in addition to using the national pipeline mapping system, that TransCanada should have a process for incorporating local knowledge. What are you referring to there? What should they do to, what sort of local knowledge are you talking about, and what do they do to obtain such knowledge?
If there is other information that TransCanada learns regarding HCAs, even if it is not included in the national pipeline mapping system, they should include it in their integrity management program.
And what sort of protections then are necessary for HCAs with a pipeline such as this? Do you have, is that in your area of expertise or not?
What do you mean by protection?
Well, what do you have to, if you identify an HCA or a USA, what do you have to do then? Other than, do you say it's there, or do you have to do something to protect it?
Well, 195.452 gives specific guidelines that a pipeline operator has to follow for HCAs.
Do you know whether TransCanada has attempted to obtain any of this local knowledge that you referred to?
I do not know.
I can't remember if this was mentioned, but you do say in your testimony that you have not determined what should or should not be classified as an HCA along this proposed route.
That is correct.
And that to do so takes a detailed analysis, is that right?
Correct.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Mr. Hone?
Would the HCA map show existing gas and hazardous liquid pipelines?
I believe they do, yes.
And to follow up on local knowledge, would local knowledge include state geological reports?
It could.
Would local knowledge include input or comments or testimony from local landowners?
It could.
Was the National Pipeline System Identification System, when was that established, if you know?
I do not know the specific date.
On page 2 of your direct testimony, under integrity management, it's line 11. After several high-profile pipeline ruptures in the United States, the government identified the need to implement additional regulations. Do you know what the high-profile ruptures were that caused that?
One that comes to mind is the event in Carlsbad, New Mexico.
Carlsbad, New Mexico, it was a gas line?
That is correct.
Did that result in regulations changing for both oil and gas lines?
There is a similar integrity management rule for natural gas lines.
Okay. And on that same page, line 28, 27 and 28, the pipeline operator is not required to have a written integrity management plan until 1 year after the date of pipeline begins operation. Do you know why the 1 year wait before this integrity management plan is implemented?
I'm going to object. It's rule, and we can't change it.
I think he's just asking her if she knows why it's like that. If you know, if you don't know, don't answer.
I do not know.
In your opinion, as a professional who reviews these projects, would you think it may be helpful to have that in advance of the pipeline going into operation?
Again, I'll object. Same grounds. We can't change it. It's federal code.
Can you rephrase the question, Kurt? Or can you tell me? I didn't catch exactly the way you asked that. I'm sorry.
In her opinion, as a professional, someone who reviews these kind of projects, would it be helpful to have the written integrity management plan in advance of the project going into operation?
And it's simply irrelevant. It doesn't matter. We can't change that.
Well, I think it is what it is, but if you're asking for her opinion on whether it would, that's fine, but realizing the rule is what it is.
Yes, I realize it.
Mr. Smith, if this question is inappropriate this time, let me know. But, I mean, isn't it possible that the commission might require the completion of a report prior to when federal statute might ask for it to be?
Well, that's one reason I'm kind of – that's one reason I wouldn't mind allowing her to answer in that – I'm not quite sure there's a legal issue, obviously.
I mean, maybe there's federal preemption. Maybe there's not.
A big legal issue, and that is the extent to which we can require things outside of what the federal government requires. But – to the extent we might be able to do that, and I don't know if I can answer that question right now, I would just soon know what you think. If you have an opinion. If you don't have one,
my answer to that is that it's not required by code.
But in your opinion, would it be helpful?
It's not required by code.
Okay, thank you. Page 36 and 37.
Line 36 and 37?
I'm sorry, line 36 and 37, page 2 still. Your answer to that question is no, TransCanada has not operated liquid pipelines since the 1990s. This was before the Hazardous Liquid Integrity Management Rule went into effect. What do you mean by operated liquid pipelines since 1990? Did they operate a liquid pipeline prior to 1990? In your knowledge?
My understanding was TransCanada had operated liquid pipelines in the past.
I thought that I heard testimony that they had helped build but had not operated, and that's why I'm asking the question. Do you have information that would...
Well, I'm going to object. I think that testimony misstates the record.
Sustained, anyway. Do you know... If you don't, do you know the answer to that question?
I guess I'm not 100% positive.
Okay. I think there are many better witnesses here to answer that.
Moving along. On the bottom of page 3 of your direct testimony, there's on line 41 through 46, if any of the pipelines owned or operated by the applicant received a notice of probable violation, and your answer is, no, TransCanada has received a notice of amendment. What is a notice of amendment?
In general, a notice of amendment is a, as stated earlier in my written testimony, a notice of amendment is a notice identifying shortcomings in an operator's integrity management plan.
Okay. Thank you. On page 5 of your direct testimony, line 23 through 27 refers to community water systems and non-transit non-community water systems. They are covered under HCA in the federal guidelines. Is that right?
Can you repeat the question, please?
You list examples of drinking water resources included but are not limited to the water intake for a community water system or a non-transient non-community water system that obtains its water supply primarily from a surface water source. Examples of drinking water resources included but are not limited to. Is drinking water in general, in your opinion, considered an HCA?
The federal government gives a specific definition for an HCA in 195.450.
And is this statement saying that in general water systems are, or does the regulation state, in your opinion, that water and water systems are covered under HCA?
There is a specific definition given in 195.450.
That same page, line 33 through 37, TransCanada has identified 40.7 miles of pipe that has a possibility of affecting an HCA in the event of a pipeline release. Did you confirm that in the review of the documents?
I obtained that information from documents.
From the documents filed?
Correct.
Which were those documents that you looked at to confirm the 40.7 miles?
I do not recall specifically which document it was.
That's a pretty specific number, 40.7. Was it identified on a line drawing showing mileposts?
I do not specifically remember which document it was.
Same page, line 43, TransCanada has identified 9 HCA locations. Did you see documents that you felt could confirm that there were 9 locations?
Yes, I did.
Did you review the HCA map that's on file, marked confidential?
I reviewed some HCA maps, yes.
Do you recall whether they were confidential? Did you have to sign something to look at the documents?
Staff signed, and as a consultant, she, of course, fell underneath that agreement, and I find it irrelevant.
Yeah, it's staff is covered in any case by confidentiality commitments here.
Yes, I understand. I was just trying to verify if she had seen the map.
Right, yeah. I think she answered that.
Okay. Page 6 of your direct testimony. From line 11 to 30. Line 16. TransCanada screened HCAs to determine which HCAs were within reasonable proximity to the center line, and then later it refers to within 1 mile. Is it normal on a pipeline of this, or common, I guess, on a pipeline of this type, from your experience, that the HCA be 1 mile from center line, or can it be broader than that?
Different pipeline operators can use different criteria.
There's nothing in the regulations that would prevent them from looking at a wider area?
The regulations are not specific.
Okay. Page page 7 of your direct testimony, lines 21 through 31. On line 29, you state, additionally, the presence of a thick clay layer between the pipeline and the aquifer would prevent crude oil from reaching the aquifer. Do you see that part of it?
Yes, I do.
Were you present when Dr. Perry Ron and Dr. Arden Davis testified on the geology?
No, I was not.
Were you monitoring the testimony by computer or
I listened to some testimony over the Internet.
Were you able, or did you have time to review the testimony submitted by Dr. Ron and Dr. Davis?
The written testimony?
Yes.
I believe I did.
Do you recall their testimony that part of the pipeline route is in a shallow aquifer area?
I do not recall that.
Okay. On page 8 of your testimony, direct testimony 22 through 31, the second line of the answer, line 27, each side of a reservoir containing water for human consumption. What is the meaning of reservoir? Is it an open body or is it a water tank? Or what's your intent there by that reference?
I believe that term is used in Part 195.
And from your knowledge and review of 195, are they referring to a lake, an open body of water, or a storage tank reservoir?
I would need to go back to 195 and review the definition.
Okay, thank you. That's all. Thank you.
Commissioner questions? Ms. Hudson? Commissioner Colbeck?
In your opinion, do you think that an integrity management plan could be drafted with correct information prior to the 1 year after operation?
I'm not sure that all of the information could be included.
Okay. Thank you.
Other commission questions?
Hi, Ms. Hudson.
Hi.
Mr. Holland asked some questions with regard to distance from the center line of a pipeline. HCA's within 1 mile, as TransCanada has done their analysis. Is that sufficient? Would you have a greater level of comfort if that distance was greater than 1 mile?
It really depends on the geology and the specific conditions around the pipeline.
Given the conditions in South Dakota as you know them to be, would you recommend greater than a 1 mile distance for evaluation purposes?
I guess I would defer that question, not being a practicing geologist.
Is there anybody else, do you know, on the staff's witness list that might be better able to answer that question?
I believe that Brian Murdoch would be able to ask that question.
Great. And Ms. Summer can certainly let me know later if that's not where the question should go. I think that's all I've got, Mr. Smith. Thanks. Thanks.
Thank you. Any redirect by staff?
You suggested that some local input, local knowledge is important in identifying HCAs. Would you consider data requests that TransCanada made to the South Dakota DE&R for source water protection areas an effort to obtain such local knowledge?
Yes, I would.
Thank you.
Is that all your questions? Any recross?
Just a couple. Are you aware of any conditions in the special permit that might relate to the reporting of newly identified HCAs to the PHMSA?
I would have to review the permit again.
Okay. And is it your understanding that Keystone will perform a fate and transport analysis as part of its emergency response planning?
That is my understanding.
And will that help to ensure that any HCAs that might be impacted by a spill are properly identified?
Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilson, any follow-up?
On this issue of the local knowledge, are there any regulations or standards that are as to what you're supposed to do to gather the local knowledge?
There are no specific requirements given in code.
And then finally, on with this question of the proximity criteria, you state on page 6 of your direct testimony that from the information available to me, I have not seen technical justification for these proximity criteria. What sort of technical justification are you talking about there?
During a jurisdictional audit, PHMSA would expect a pipeline operator to have documentation discussing any assumptions that they have made in the development of their integrity management program.
Is that something that would typically be prepared at this stage or at some later time?
I would think it would be developed at a later time.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Any last
questions?
Thank you, Ms. Hudson. I think you may step down.
Mr. Smith, I might just note that call to your attention that there was one of the interveners in the audience that made some gestures that I think was meant to call into question the integrity of that witness. And I just think that all interveners have an opportunity to cross-examine a witness.
Sure.
They question the professionalism or a credentials of a witness, and I think doing it in the audience is inappropriate and disrespectful.
Thank you. Is this a good time to call it a day, I'm seeing at least one commissioner nod yes. And unless two of the other two say no, I'm going to say.
I would, defer to Sherry and the parties. If people feel as though we to complete our work, we have to push on, then by all means, let's push on. If this is an appropriate breaking time, then you're not going to, need to convince me.
I think it's an appropriate breaking time. Staff will jump into it's Bay West witnesses, which is an entirely different subject matter.
Okay. Sounds like a logical point to take a break then. Any thoughts on your end? You probably want to get going anyway, don't you, Mr. Rasmussen?
Well, that's not really I'm flying out of here tomorrow morning, so
oh,
it really
okay.
doesn't matter.
Okay. Irrelevant. How about the applicant?
I think we'd agree it's probably a good time for a break, given the break in the train of witnesses.
Okay. In that case, we will stand in recess until 8:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Pardon.